This week's episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by the following advertisers.
Get ready to delve deep into the weird world of essential cult entertainment only on Full Moon's Amazon channel. Classic Full Moon and Empire Picture faves like Castle Freak, Puppet Master, Subspecies, Necropolis, Intruder, Head of the Family, Evil Bong, The Ginger Dead Man, Laser Blast, The Pit and the Pendulum, and Lurking Fear share space with a wild library of cult creepers from the legendary Blue Underground and Something Weird video labels, the Andy Sedaris and Jess Franco collections, as well as the Euro Archives, Trailers from Hell, and much, much more. This is an unlimited onslaught of awesome right at your fingertips 24/7. New uncut movies are added every week, and all the titles are available in the highest definition available. So get yourself over to Amazon and subscribe to Full Moon today for only $6.99 per month. Your glaze balls will never be the same again. Trust us.
In just a couple of weeks, Shockwaves is heading to Texas Frightmare Weekend, presented by Arrow Video. The convention takes place May 3rd to the 5th at the Hyatt Regency Hotel at the DFW Airport. It's the Southwest's premier horror convention, now in its 14th year. Join the Shockwaves team for a live show on Saturday, May 4th at 11 a.m. in the Maverick Room. And look for us all weekend long at booth 31 and 32. Special guests this year include Bruce Campbell, Sam Raimi, Tim Curry, Robert Englund, Lee Majors, Meatloaf, Joe Bob Briggs, and many more. For further details, visit TexasFrightmareWeekend.com.
Severn Films has plenty of releases in store for you this May, and they're all available for pre-order at severn-films.com. In 1977, legendary Amicus co-founder Milton Subutsky teamed with Canadian producer Claude Heureau for the killer cat anthology The Uncanny. Peter Cushing, Ray Milland, Donald Pleasant, Samantha Eggar, and Susan Penhaligon star in this grisly portmanteau. The Uncanny is coming to Blu-ray for the first time ever.
Plus, the world premiere of the hallucinatory epic from Gabe Bartolos, Saint Bernard. You know him from his unhinged effects work on Frankenhooker, Brain Damage, and the Leprechaun series, and now he brings his own psychotic vision to the screen. Frank Henenlotter calls Saint Bernard a wonderfully fucked up masterpiece. Look for it in May on Blu-ray and digital platforms. And new from Intravision, in 1994, a production team in eastern Pennsylvania brought together a group of local pro wrestlers and young actors to make a horror action film. A quarter of a century later, the movie was finally finished. The Masked Mutilator. When a psychopath wearing a wrestling mask begins butchering the teenage residents of a youth offender's home, the rehabilitation will become a no-holds-barred battle for survival. The Uncanny, Saint Bernard, and The Masked Mutilator coming in May, available for pre-order from Severn-Films.com. Meow. Okay, welcome to episode 140 of Shockwaves. We made it to 140, which is now tied with Killer POV.
Oh my gosh, we've almost outdone ourselves.
Yeah, I predict we won't make it past.
What the hell, Elric?
The final episode?
I feel like something to do with our guest will throw this all off and it'll all go to fucking hell.
What the hell is the doomsday soothsaying there? Just be quiet.
Saying. Okay, well, just in case this does continue, I'm Rob Galuzzo, one of the hosts. Rebecca McKendry's here as well, laughing along. Elric Kane, the pessimist of the group.
What the fuck do you know? That's from God Told Me To. It's the best line in there.
Yes. You're all Larry Cohen Doubt.
I'm Larry Cohen Doubt.
I didn't even introduce Ryan yet.
Hey,
I
know. I'm another host on the show. You may know me.
With us also, Ryan Turek.
Yes. Hey, how's it going, guys?
What's up, man?
You know, we outdid Killer POV.
Yay!
You know? Remember my run on Killer POV?
I thought we just tied.
We're getting there. Elric's all doomsday.
No, I love throwing the Bloodcast whenever I can.
How many Bloodcast episodes were there?
What is that one? Oh, you mean Clark Wolf's show.
I don't remember.
Wow. But how many did you host?
I don't remember. I think I came in at 20.
Oh, okay.
I came in at number 20, and then the show found its focus.
Right, because it was a true blood
Wasn't your True Blood podcast?
No, it was a True Blood podcast.
Yes, it was. It totally was.
Yeah.
Just True Blood the entire way.
We had True Blood guests, but it wasn't a True Blood podcast.
I'm going to look this up.
Oh, you mean before my time?
Bloodcast was created as a True Blood podcast.
Yeah, I don't remember any of that.
That's what I'm talking about, the 20 episodes that don't count.
So the 20 episodes were all True Blood, and then Ryan came.
And then I came in and was like, we're going to sweep up this joint and talk about horror. And then I'll never forget the time when I just had to do an episode by myself.
I was getting ready to talk about that because I feel like we need to make Ryan do that at some point where he just has to do a whole episode by himself.
Rob has, right? You've done a whole episode by yourself, haven't you?
I cheated.
It was an interview.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
It's much easier to do that.
I just rambled for like 45 minutes.
Did you end up walking from the show, or did the show get shut down? I can't even remember how it ended.
How did that
end? Or did you get the job?
Well, I think you started this, and you just didn't have time for it anymore. I think you guys...
No, because he'd left before we started this.
Yeah, I think I got the Blumhouse job, and then I was like, I got to go. All my extracurricular activities
had to go away.
Dead
Right,
Dead Right Horror Trivia and Bloodcast.
I just love that we now have a podcast that's about our old podcast. This is what the focus of the show should be.
Hey, guys.
Yeah.
Who's this guy in the room?
Oh, I don't know.
Ernie. Hey, Ernie.
Ernie, what's up, man? How you doing?
Ernie, what's up?
Good to see you.
Hey, who's the dude to your right?
What?
I know.
The guy with all the Blumhouse films?
He's really dapper.
Hey, guys.
And I hear he likes James Bond a lot.
I brought my Fangoria number 3 to read on the plane.
Could it be Timothy Dalton?
Close. No.
Hey, that's my favorite James Bond, by the way.
What? No, it's Honor Majesty.
Before we start getting into James Bond talk, hold it right there.
Wait, who's here?
Hold
Go
it
ahead.
Right there. Let's talk about Phil Nobile, who is the editor of Fangoria magazine.
I'm so psyched that also, this is now a James Bond podcast.
Oh, yeah.
So we talk about our old podcast and James Bond,
James
but that's
Bond.
It.
I'm down for
Nothing
this
else.
James Bond.
Cool.
Phil also directed Halloween, The Inside Story.
Oh, yeah.
For Biography.
Yes.
Yeah.
Correct.
He wrote and directed that. That's how I think you
and
wait, is that the one with Brian Collins and stuff from a few years ago?
That's,
yeah.
Collins.
I saw it on the plane. It's older, right?
Yes.
I saw it on a plane really recently, and it was fucking great.
Yes. It was in-flight content recently.
Yeah. No, I literally saw it on
plane. I was like, I've made it.
You get a little cut of the money for that? You get any money for that?
I get nothing.
Not a lot.
In-flight content? I assume that paid like huge. Wow.
Not me.
And you were a producer on Horror Noir as well.
Correct. I was one of the executives. Producers on that project. Ashley Blackwell and I started that project and spent all of 2017 pitching it to anyone who'd listen. And it sold a day after Peele won the Oscar.
That's amazing.
Wow.
Yeah, Shutter called up the next
day. Nice.
Oh, well, awesome. Phil, the only reason we really have you on here is because you and I are going to go head to head on Scream 2 versus Scream 3.
Oh, I'm not qualified
to do this. And Scream 3 versus Scream 4.
Oh.
You know, I mean, like, you know, you just went on this Twitter tirade talking about how great Scream 4 is.
The first 5 minutes.
You know, I just.
You're not feeling it?
Listen, I think there was a good movie in there somewhere, and it began great for about 10 minutes and then it just kind of petered long and it was like I'm trying to get all the feels of the previous entries and it didn't quite get there until the last 30 minutes when all was revealed and I went, wow, you became a Scream movie now. All right, let's go.
Interesting.
Whereas I feel like 2 and 3 were at least spiritually in line with what they were going for.
I'm with you on 3. I think 2, it just – you feel the patchwork nature of those reshoots. Mm. Timothy Oliphant is a completely different character in that last scene than what
he's supposed to be.
Yeah, but there's certain choices there that aren't – like so he was pretending to be straight for most of the movie because he's doing a whole other thing at the end. And 4 – and I think movies can ripen with time, right? Mm-hmm. And I think maybe in 2011 Scream 4 wasn't all you wanted it to be. I think if you look at Scream 4 in 2019, it resonates in a different way.
I am due for a new revisit.
I've been meaning to because I keep thinking about a lot of the themes of Scream 4. Because, when it came out, the thing that disappointed me is the poster had the great tagline, New Decade, New Rules.
Yes.
And so you're like, oh, great. They're going to do like weird stuff that ties in new found footage and the Saw, torture porn, all that. And they just didn't at all.
Yeah.
And so you're kind of disappointed because you're like, oh, they just kind of fell back into the old Scream formula when we have a whole decade of interesting horror that we could have commented on.
It lacked the ingenuity.
Now in influencer culture,
there you go.
The ending actually is kind of like one of those, man, Craven was 10 years ahead here again.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Rob.
But I just don't think, I'm curious how the whole thing would play now. So I've got to revisit it too.
Let's do that soon.
Yeah, let's do the whole screen.
I'm down for the whole quartet.
And I feel I 2 and 3 I loved when they came out, and I like 3 better than 2. And
same.
I know it's a and I'll two words, Parker Posey. That's my main reason why.
Basically anything she's in I'm liking, but yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, I don't know. Two. The last time I revisited 2, I remember being like offended by it, like how much, especially the opening scene.
You all
that how offended I was by like
offended.
How it's pretty. I don't know. I watched the opening again. I found it kind of racist. The opening of Scream 2 in comparison to what I was like. Oh yeah, this is really not. Anyway,
I disagree, but I think that it was definitely Craven at the top of his craft in terms of orchestrating some really great thrills.
Yeah, the car scene is excellent.
All of that stuff is fantastic.
But my problem with 2 and 3, and again, we should revisit these, is kind of my problem with Back to the Future 2 and 3, which I love, which is Scream 1 on its own, total classic. Two yes. and three can't stand up on their own. They rely correct. Too heavily on your knowledge of the first one to exist,
and
which at
and
the time is interesting.
And the fans will tell you that that's part of the commentary, is that it's a meta sequel and that's very much part of the fabric of the movie. But two lost me in that college scene where it felt very much like a 70-year-old man writing a scene that he thought film students would have, a dialogue scene.
Well, that's all I felt so like 4 is. I felt like 4 was, you know, a 70-year-old man, you know, trying to, you know, 2011 teenagers, you know. I just kind of –
But then he nailed it with My Soul to Take. What a youthful vision that was, you know.
Yeah.
Anyways, I kid and I jest, but I was eager to get you face to face because we went back and forth on Twitter.
Well,
and,
I have a Twitter follow up for you. You had mentioned on Twitter last week that you hadn't watched the John Wick movies, and it made me wonder because I saw the pictures from your horror themed wedding.
None of them?
Congratulations,
oh,
by
thank
the way,
you.
And so. And you live and breathe horror, and it's like you're walking the walk, right? Uh-huh. But do you not watch stuff that's not horror?
Absolutely. Yeah, what? I just did Bohemian Rhapsody and The Dirt double feature 2 nights ago.
The Dirt was so fun.
The Dirt went to places I didn't expect in that first 5 minutes. I was like, whoa, that's like borderline porn.
I had so much fun with that movie.
No, I do. The John Wick movies,
The dog.
The dog.
It's not about the dog. I mean,
that's
like,
the dog for me.
The first one was partially about the dog, but when
Wait, you have seen it.
No, I haven't seen it. I heard about it, though. I haven't seen the John Wick movies at all. But, you know, when I took this job, you know what was really funny is when I was a journalist, I always interviewed people and I'd always be talking about, oh, have you seen this and have you seen that? And it wasn't like an arrogant, I'm better than you because I'm watching all these movies. It was just like, I want to see what you're keeping up with.
Yeah.
And most of the filmmakers I talked to were like, shit, man, I haven't had time to watch anything yet. You know, and I'll talk to filmmakers coming off a movie and they'll say, oh, I'm finally catching up with all of these shows.
Right.
And I feel that every day now.
So you're
and
too
I
much
felt
of a
like
big
that.
Shot now.
No, not at all. No. No,
he's
you
can
have
you
a permanent role
trick.
On the show. I'm inviting you as a co-host forever.
So which films are you too good to watch now?
I just usually give him shit for
really,
not reading.
Really
so you can come
ones.
On anytime.
Really
but,
fancy
but he does have time for Splatter University and whatever
yeah.
else he's talking
yeah,
about every week.
Yeah. Fuck yeah. True to your roots. Listen, I mean, like, you got to pick your, you know, as you get older, too, I think it's like it's an age thing as well. You just got to pick and choose what you're really going to enjoy and get into.
That's fair.
That said, I've got a date on Friday night because the family wants to watch The Favorite, and I'm like, okay, that's cool. The kid wants to see The Favorite. I will watch The Favorite because
awesome.
I like Orgos too. I'm
yeah.
very eager, and I missed it at the theater.
It's
but
great.
No, I watch other stuff.
Okay.
You can follow me on Letterboxd and check out the titles.
I'm gonna.
I won't rate anything, but you'll see
you
my.
Don't rate it. That's
you'll
right.
see as cam director Danny said to me at Sundance, he's like, you have a very eclectic taste, Ryan.
Nice.
He's like, I like how you go for these really weird bottom of the barrel movies, and then suddenly it's like super classy.
All right.
Yeah.
Wait,
yeah.
Do you write many reviews? No.
No, no.
Okay.
No.
So just
I just log. I log
I
what
log.
I watch.
I log what I
so
watch.
So I can, when somebody says, what have you seen? It's just so easy to pull it up because I can't damn remember half the time.
Yeah. Although it was refreshing to watch Bohemian Rhapsody and The Dirt back to back and not have anything horrifying.
You should do John Wick 1, though, because it's like fantastic.
I'll watch it.
Especially given that you guys made Upgrade, I feel like there's a kinship between those two films. I think they're two of the best action and comedy films made in the last decade. So it's a great movie. Two I like a lot as well.
Yeah.
A lot of people thought it was better than, but I still think the first one's
definitely.
Such a great story.
Yeah, the first one's the one.
Yeah. So on Her Majesty's Secret Service, because let's just cut to the Aussie
Do you want to call this the Bondcast?
Well, how do you feel about an Aussie Bond?
He was fine.
Yeah. That's a good movie.
It's one of my favorites.
Yeah, no, I knew that about because of Twitter. This is a Twitter conversation we're all having.
So basically, much like the Scream sequels, you need a lot of context on Twitter and our previous podcast to understand this episode.
To understand everything that has occurred today.
There's going to be an appendix to this, a suggested
But I serious bomb question before we move on, because I am curious, because you're so into it, and I love the series too. What do you think the next iteration will be once we finish the Daniel Craig story?
Should or will, because those are different things.
Well, what would you want it to be? What would you like to see?
The Fleming books are very weird and a little kinky and not afraid to get goofy. Uh-huh. And I don't mean in a Roger Moore way, but there's some weird shit in the books. And I would like Daniel Craig has set this course to be a very grounded sort of take.
Hyper realist.
And I've been waiting for him to get a little loose with it, and it's not happening, and that's fine. But I hope that the next iteration gets a little weird and brings some of that –
insight into why the Daniel Craig ones are as serious as they are.
Please.
Only because I had a conversation with somebody in the know.
Uh-oh. Ooh, one of the Broccolis? No. You friends with the Broccoli?
No, this is legit. I've seen a lot of the Bond films, not all of them. Timothy Dalton's my guy because those are the ones I saw in the theater with my dad. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So those are my favorites. But I've been revisiting them from the beginning in chronological order. And what's funny is I like the first few movies, but I laughed out loud at so much stuff because Austin Powers is so embedded in my mind that when you see an evil guy petting a cat but you don't see him, you can't not be like, oh, it's Dr. Evil.
It's over.
Even though it's not. And you know, so it's like Austin Powers has totally ruined those movies in that camp. And when somebody involved in the production said that is what – because everyone knows Austin Powers.
Yeah.
Maybe not as much now as they did 10 years ago, but when the Daniel Craig iteration happened, they are consciously trying to avoid ever doing anything that could be confused with Austin Powers.
Oh, sure. But there's so much crazier shit in the books that they could get into, and they haven't. The whole Garden of Death thing, and like there's all kinds of places to go.
Cool. Octopussy, yes or no?
No.
See, I really loved it when I was young, and I am scared to revisit.
Yeah, it's
it taught me everything I knew about making love.
Some folks are big fans. I think Moore should have quit two films earlier.
Becca's face right there was quite.
I've only seen a couple of the Bond films. I'll start with that. I've seen a few of them. Duran Duran was there, and that's
Have you seen Octopussy?
Because I have seen Octopussy and Goldfinger, and that's about where my knowledge stopped. Okay. I saw the kind of campy, gimmicky ones from the '70s, where all of the women had to have a thing.
You didn't see Casino Royale? You might really like that one.
I have not.
Casino Royale is
really great.
Martin Campbell, who is a New Zealander, reinvented the franchise twice.
Yes.
And he's a really good director.
No, I mean, like, you guys know that most of the time, if I'm not watching horror, I kind of require giant explosions. So I would probably fucking love these movies.
There's a couple of those.
Like, I fucking love John Wick.
It's a Spectre that opens with a crazy, like, this building being destroyed and he keeps running.
I'm looking at Ryan and I'm like, yes, we will get back to the horror on this horror podcast.
I cut all this, right?
I was having fun.
Well, the other thing is like, you know, I kind of tend to dip out when the quality dips. So, you know, the Bond movies, I was like, you know, okay.
Quantum of Solace was rough, man.
Casino Royale.
What's the Bardem one? Yeah. What's the one with Javier Bardem?
Skyfall.
That's a good one. He's fucking amazing.
It's the last good one.
Yeah. Have you seen that one?
No.
Javier.
That was great. Yeah.
They imply the gay subtext, which I just didn't think they could go to with Bond. It was amazing.
And shot by.
Is it Connery?
Deacons?
Oh, Deacons, yeah. Deacons shot a few in a row.
Beautiful.
Right?
No, he just shot the one.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Golden.
So, guys,
I saw that like
welcome
podcast.
To the horror podcast.
Sorry, welcome to Shockwaves. I hope you've skipped ahead if you don't want to hear Bond talk. But anyway, before we do our whole usual spiel with like the interview and chatting about things,
we got to talk about
what we've seen.
Yeah.
You guys should talk about where you're going this
Oh, that's right. Oh, my God.
We are en route. Like, literally, we are going to leave the show and head to the airport to head to the Chattanooga Film Festival.
By the time you listen to it. Rebecca, Rob, and Elric will be on the ground.
Yes.
That's right.
I don't know. It takes a really long time to get to Chattanooga, and we have a layover.
We're doing trivia. We have a live show. We're doing a off-site recorded show. We won't reveal just yet in case it doesn't happen, but hopefully it'll be awesome. And then I don't know about you, but I get to introduce fucking Vice Squad, and it's like the thrill of my life. And I'm going to walk in like doing the wings. I'm very excited about that.
While you were introducing Vice Squad, which breaks my heart that I will miss that.
What the fuck? You're missing Vice Squad?
I know. Dave Lawson and Robert Cargill asked me to join the D&D game, so I am now part of the live D&D show.
I
brought my bag of dice. I'm ready to go. So my six demon bag. And Then I'm also doing the pitch session with Dave Lawson. I will be helping out with that.
Is that a panel?
He's literally teaching a class on how to pitch. And so
interesting.
I am doing the first one so that he can like say what to do, what not to do, things like this. And then from there, he's inviting audience and attendees to come up and pitch and give them feedback about the project. So
nice.
It's pretty cool. So yeah. And there's tons of movies going on as well. What are you guys excited to see?
Well, I'm introducing a film called The Fair, so you should, and unfortunately it might be during your Vice Squad as well, which I think is really cool. It's a very Twilight Zone-esque movie, and I freaking love the Twilight Zone.
Mm-hmm.
I got a sneak peek at a movie called Fingers. That,
that's one I can't wait to see. It looks
Jeremy
so trippy.
Jeremy Gardner's in, and Michael St. Michael's from Greasy Strangler, and I loved it. It is not like this movie at all, but the closest – the in terms of the way the tone goes, it's kind of cheap thrills-ish in terms of like terrible people just – continuing to do terrible things to each other.
I'm kind of
so
in.
I think that's kind of funny, and you should definitely check that one out.
That's tomorrow night that we get to see that one.
Well, you know, whenever this airs, yesterday night.
Oh, yeah. So
and by the way, I'm really, really, really looking forward to Joe Bob Briggs' lecture, which would have happened by the time you hear this. Sorry. But the reason I bring it up is because last year – were you with me last year for
I was at it, but I wasn't with you.
Okay. So he gave this – Joe Bob came on stage at Chattanooga. He's been a guest there every year. Mm-hmm. And he gave this incredible, in-depth – lecture about the history of exploitation in cinema, starting from the beginning of cinema and like the first on-screen kiss and how salacious that was. And he made it up to about like the 70s, and it was like 2 hours long.
I think it was
long.
Even before the 70s. He didn't even get to like the juicy stuff, and yet it was completely hypnotic.
Hypnotic.
It was like 60s maybe.
It was 2 hours long. It was incredible. He had a slideshow. It was so entertaining and
was
funny.
Was it Mae West that he did the whole thing on?
Yeah.
It was incredible.
Like, and then he gets to the 70s like – all right, so 70s to now, you'll have to come back next year for part two of my lecture. Yeah. And we're like, so I'm very excited for part two of this lecture. It's a year later.
It's going to get the wild stuff.
This is like when it really gets into the stuff that, you know, that I absolutely love because it gets into kind of the underground and the grindhouse and how, you know, people out of the middle of nowhere started making these films that changed Hollywood in this way. And I'm so excited to get into it.
Well, it's also, you know, before the comeback on Shudder, which has been obviously fantastic for Joe Bob's, you know, reputation. I think there was that period right after we did the show where a lot of people were being critical and saying, oh, this guy's a redneck. And I remember going, then you've never seen him live because the guy's a fucking academic professor.
Oh, my God.
You know, and this is a persona that you're seeing projected. And you really do need to see this guy talk about films. He's a scholar, and it's really impressive. So if you get a chance to be there, get to it.
Yeah, there's some films I'm really psyched about. Hellbound looks definitely
like
my jam. Yeah, it is. In Fabric, The Confessional
one of the best of last
looks
year.
Really good. Oh, yeah. So there's just a bunch that I'm
I want to see Travis Stevens' movie. I think it
Girl
plays after we leave.
Floor.
Girl on the Third Floor.
I like that one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Harpoon. It looked intriguing to me. There was a couple that I was kind of
Chattanooga.
Jealous
yet? Chattanooga, guys.
No, because I will be at Monsterpalooza roaming the aisles, buying things, going to the Fango table.
Come to the Fango table.
Checking out the cool guests. So if you're at
Monsterpalooza
this weekend, come on by and say hi.
There's a Dread table, too, so –
go don't
over
Dread
there and
go
buy Fango. Go to Fango and Dread.
All right, back to Bond.
Okay.
So, really quick, Bond podcast.
I wanted to talk more about Killer POV, guys. On the Bloodcast.
One thing I do want to bring up is American Horror Story on the day of this recording announced their new season.
Pretty cool.
And it's totally my jam.
What is it?
American Horror Story 1984. Set at a summer camp, and it's a slasher season.
Okay, you know what?
I'll jump back in.
Wait, no, I may come back for this.
You know what? Last season was
the apocalypse.
Not that bad. I liked Apocalypse.
Phil's nodding no. So what kind of no is that?
Oh, no. I just know that I'm going to be tasked with making sure that there's some Fango product placement in the 1984 set slasher series. And I hope they see things my way. That's all. It's all good.
Fair.
Yeah.
I liked the one before Apocalypse, but only the first like few episodes. Cult.
Oh, my God. I never ducked out of one so fast in my life.
I had like two episodes of that I'm intrigued where they're going. And then I was done.
I watched one and I was done.
And I didn't like Freak Show at all.
Freak
but
Show,
I know people who love
halfway
that one. Yeah. No. So,
I liked parts of Freak Show, but yeah, I haven't really liked it, a full season of it, for a long time.
Yeah, I haven't either. I'd stepped
no
out.
Has.
Yeah,
so.
It's hard to. I think it's too many episodes.
It's hard to break up with it. It's hard to break up.
I think if they went down to 8 episodes, it'd be stronger, more cinematic. It just loses focus.
Whatever the one was with the Blood Moon and the Roanoke Colony.
Oh, yeah.
I was that one lost me on the first episode.
Mm-hmm. I went through that one too.
Yeah.
Anyways,
that was very sad. That was a sad discussion,
yeah,
guys.
It's hopeful.
I was going to say, because the, you know, we watched that season of American Horror Story, the one with the one on the Colin, Roanoke Colony.
The Roanoke Colony.
And then we went through the Universal Halloween Horror Nights maze, and I went, it's the first time the maze is better than the thing it's based on. Mm. Like, I actually understood the storyline and the production design. That really scared me.
Everyone should have gone through the maze.
Just go through the maze and experience this season. Anyways, we got lots to discuss, things to watch.
Well, on TV, I'll say at the top that Santa Clarita Diet, I have now finished what was released. Is it not amazing?
I love it.
I love it so much. I think it is quite possibly some of the strongest writing right now, like, that I have seen in a long time.
It took me a minute to get on board, but I, like, burned through season 2 in a day.
Is season 2 season not two is amazing?
Terrific. So great.
Season 3, it's the same way. It just goes in firing all guns, and it's phenomenal.
You're saying I should get back in the saddle.
Oh, my God, yeah. I burned through season 2, and season 3 is... It just – because season 2 ends on this amazing high note, and season 3 picks right up there, keeps going. Mm. And I watched all of season 3 within a week.
Nice.
So, yeah. Cool. And it's they really start playing with – this isn't a spoiler, but they really start using the Mr. Ball Legs character, which I was so happy about, which is designed by Clint Carney.
Clint Carney.
Yeah. And it's just – it's like a little meatball-sized chunk of flesh with little spidery legs sticking out. But he's really cute.
It's sentient, and it's like a symbiote. It's connected to its host, kind of.
Ryan, you need to keep watching.
Dr. Hill with bat wings? Weird? I mean,
well, it doesn't talk.
No, it doesn't, talk. But it emotes. It's
is
Mr. Ball Legs.
Still in it? Nathan Fillion?
Shit.
Yeah.
As no.
Yeah. Well, no. They actually sub him out in this season.
But do you know who with?
Who is he? I knew that the voice
who's
had
the
changed.
Guy? I have to look it up. Keep
going. Oh, you mean the character is still in it? But
the character is still in it, but he's fully decayed at this point.
Okay.
Like he's like a decayed head that is still downstairs talking. That's he takes over to their realty agency because he has a headset and he takes over their realty agency.
That's pretty amazing.
This all happens in the first 5 minutes of the season because they're like, what do we do with the head in the basement? And he's like, I just want to work, guys.
Alan Tudyk.
Oh, that makes
sense. Wait, they replaced him with the guy from his own show? That's amazing. Alan Tudyk's a great voice actor.
Wow.
That is Serenity replacement. I
caught
love
that
it.
The voice had changed, but was just like, whatever.
And they wrote
so
it
good.
In. Well, your voice box seems to have fallen to the bottom of the vase.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then they show that the voice box is sitting at the bottom of the table and it fell out of his head. And they're like, whatever.
That is amazing.
It's great. I highly recommend jumping back in. And obviously only on the second episode of Shadows, but what we do in the Shadows.
Oh.
But still,
so
the second
good.
Episode was amazing.
So
just
good.
Rolling the whole time. God. And I went back and rewatched the first episode again because I had to hear
I've seen
paper.
I've watched both episodes twice now and they're so good. Did you catch up on any Sabrina season 2?
I have not. I binged the rest of Santa Clarita and that
got
was
it.
My week.
Sabrina season 2 starts off incredibly strong. It's obviously Sabrina taking on the patriarchy of her school and basically because she signed the book and signed her soul over to the devil, she's just kind of like waiting for the devil to pop up and tell her what to do. He's supposed to give her instructions. And I got to episode 2 where he's finally like telling her what she needs to do. And of course she's Sabrina. So she starts to fight back. So he's like, just steal a pack of gum. And she's like, and she goes to try to do it. And she does, she gets caught in the act and she's like, I'm not stealing this gum. And then he just keeps amplifying it and the stakes get higher and higher. But what she doesn't know is that the devil is doing this for a bet with her principal. And the principal is like, Sabrina's too good. She'll never do what you ask. And he's like, let's bet on that. And so it's a really fun, fun episode. But again, great production value, great performances. I mean, like, it's just one of those shows that I love. And any show that tips its hat to the Damien Omen 2,
yeah,
fucking amazing. Because she's going through these trials. And the high priest that her basically principal of her dark school, he starts grilling her on which history, and he's asking her like famous dates and famous people, and she's like rapid fire nailing him off, much like Damien when he's in Damien Omen 2 when he's at school and the principal is just kind of grilling him on dates. But we all know obviously Damien's the Antichrist and he's being fed these questions these answers, but it's almost like, you know, beat for beat, the exact same scene and the same cadence and the same rhythm. It's fantastic. I love it.
How the hell did they make, like, The first season was October. How the hell did they finish a second season?
They were already,
I feel like they must have shot.
They were already shooting. They were already shooting season two at the tail end. They went right into season two from my understanding.
All
so,
right. But yeah. That was a really fast turnaround.
It was. Yeah. And now they're at 3 and 4.
Holy smokes.
Oh wow! They've already got two more in the works.
I can't keep up with these shows, man. It's too much.
There's a lot.
I mean, I'm trying to get import DVDs and stuff and Blu-rays to watch. But do we want to delve into last week's movie, Pet Sematary? Sure. Did you get to see it a second time, Ryan?
I did.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, I'm curious how you felt about it the second time. So, so obviously, last week we had a very spoiler-filled episode because it's kind of impossible not to talk about it. You've seen
Phil,
this movie,
you seen it?
I have.
Okay. Yes, yeah, so I'd like to – I hope so since it's in your magazine.
Yeah.
I figured you probably saw it at this point.
Yeah.
So what's everyone's general reaction to this? Because I only got to see it the one time, which was the preview screening before Dennis and Kevin came on. And as I told them when they were on last week, I was honestly really mixed on that first – viewing. And I think a big part of it is because for a lot of us in this room, we were all a pretty indelible age when that first movie came out. And it's one of the first Stephen King books I remember reading because the movie, you know, I was old enough to read the book and see the movie, etc. And the first half to me felt very familiar. Like they obviously did their own take on it, but I felt almost as if we were like kind of like, all right, we've seen this already, we've done these beats. And then it does that radical shift in the middle, and then in like all bets are off. And so the third act of the movie is a totally different beast. And I guess I just didn't know how to feel about it. I was like, I don't know how I feel about this.
Yeah.
It took a few days for me to sit on it and be like, you know what? I liked what they did. I thought it was the smart move to do something totally different with that because at least it surprised us, which Elric, you didn't watch any trailers, so you went in totally fresh and you ended up loving it quite a bit.
Yeah, it felt like when I saw The Witch because I didn't see anything of The Witch either, like no trailers or anything. And I, you know, so you're kind of hype free. Even if somebody tells you it's really great or they're overhyping it in quote marks, it doesn't really matter if you have no context. It's just words, you know, and then you watch it. It really is, but it's also really tonally my kind of horror film. That's the thing about Pet Sematary. Like they've nailed the kind of tone I go to horror for, which is it's got a lot of dread, it's creepy, it's adult. The themes, I think what it gets by using the daughter versus Gage is, to me, it got a super fascinating relationship movie between a father and daughter that's super bizarre, funny, weird, especially when Amy Simons' character is just kind of out of it for that period. And I think she's great in the movie. I think it's a fascinating movie. That two-person movie I find really engaging, and I'm just curious by it because that is a radical shift from the other movie. It has nothing to do with the other movie. It's their own movie. And that's why I love remakes, in quote marks, that are not remakes. This is a whole new vision. It's almost, if you had different named characters, you could call this a different chapter of that house and that location. If you know, not the opening, of course.
Right.
You know, the setup is playing on the how well you know the movie.
Well, it's funny that you say it could be different characters because I like the movie, but I don't love it. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just I have so much love and reverence for the original that I like the original version better. But I did go and buy Pet Sematary 2 on DVD because I totally forgot that movie existed.
I don't think I've seen that since it came out.
I haven't rewatched it.
Yeah, I remember Furlong and holding his mother's corpse and like the electrocution, and that's where I checked it out.
Edward Furlong, the kid from Big, like Anthony Edwards is the dad in that. It's like it's got a cast, and Mary Lambert directed it. Yeah. So anyway, I haven't seen it in probably, you know, whatever, 15, 20 years, but I just bought that DVD and I kind of want to go through. Now I'm like in Pet Sematary mode. I want to watch all the versions.
Yeah. I think the movie's very good. I think it's good. I think Dennis and Kevin did the feeling that I got both on the first and second viewing is that it feels very rushed.
Yeah, the pacing feels weird, doesn't
the pacing,
it?
Like, yeah,
it there just, must be a much if, longer movie there.
I don't know if there's a longer movie there. It just feels like there's a lot more excitement and energy put into the third act. Once that turn happens and we get the kind of new stuff, you could feel where Dennis and Kevin were much more excited about bringing what we'll put them on the map and starry eyes, you know, into this and bringing us into that fold and bringing us into their excitement level for Pet Sematary. And I think that once that turn happens, there's some really cool stuff. I think the little girl is very good. I think she's really scary. But the kind of beats to get to that point, yeah, there's a little bit of familiarity. That's why I want to talk to somebody who's never seen a Pet Sematary or read the book at all.
Yeah.
But the stuff with Zelda, you know, the stuff with Amy, you know, and dealing with her, you know, dealing with her thoughts on death. You know, I kind of miss the parent subplot. Mm. You know, the parent, Amy's, you know, the wife, her parents hate Lewis. You know, and I kind of miss that element.
I got that across in one shot. I just remember looking at the parents. They look like they hate that guy.
I know, but it adds a lot more to the grief. You know, that Lewis feels.
I think Lithgow's fantastic.
What's that?
I really like Lithgow in this movie. I mean,
yeah,
you know,
he's good,
and I love that he made the choice to not just replay another character. I think he did a great job.
Yeah, yeah, but
and also love all the weird Wendigo, all the weird like when they're going to the pet cemetery. That stuff is
the
a
Wendigo
bigger world.
Cool.
Well, yeah, it's just a big. They're hinting at a bigger horror map that they never go to.
The Wendigo. It backs up what happens to Ellie. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, like and we talked about this in the last episode, but it, you know, this was all in the book as well, and it's what's possessing the dead. Mm-hmm. You know, that is the major threat. It's, you know, it's using the corpse of your loved one, and it's channeling, you know, you see a little bit in this film where she's talking about Judd's wife, and like that's the true weapon that Gage in the book used against them, you know. Right. And again, I think that it was much more believable to have a little girl running around like using that stuff as opposed to like a 3-year-old boy going, "Your wife sucks," and you know, and, like, I just would never buy that.
And you could get a little philosophical, and I think that's just an interesting twist because of her age and because of how they set up the thing about death.
Right.
It's just interesting to hear what when somebody has come back from that place, their feelings on it. I think it's really interesting.
Yeah, yeah. The atmosphere all works. Yeah. It's beautifully shot. You know, I think it's good.
I love with that and Starry Eyes that they both deliver these, just they go all the way with their premise to an ending that's like goes all the way with both those movies. There's nothing held back. They're not going halfway, and I think that's great. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a playful, it's very dark ending, but it's playful, and you know, it's
I don't know if it's funny. it's playful
in the very,
in the very
last
macabre
beat.
Sense.
That's what that blood humor is. Yeah, I think so. Red humor, as Mick
Red
would
humor.
Call it, right?
I don't know, it's interesting because we're at a point now where
I don't know if I have anything to add, because I'm kind of sitting between where you and Rob are in this position, where I felt like that's a great decision thematically to have Ellie, who's obsessed with death and afraid of death, to have her cross over and be that thing. I thought she was a little chatty when she came back. Mm. The quieter moments were working better for me. The bath scene.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know what they did to that kid's face, but it was unsettling. And the scene in the bed when she's like,
"Come back to bed, Daddy."
Yeah,
that's my favorite scene.
Those quieter moments were great. And I feel like Amy Simons was kind of sidelined by a lot of this, but once she came back, there was nothing left to do but a stalk and slash kind of thing.
Yeah,
and so that felt a little less satisfying to me.
Yeah,
sadly. Mm. But I come from a different place from this affinity for the first movie. I didn't love the first movie when I saw it. You and I are maybe closer in age, but you might have been reading the same issues of Fango that I did, where Stephen King is talking about how excited he is that Romero's going to make Pet Sematary, it's going to be a combo of Night of the Living Dead and Martin, and it's going to be his deepest work, and then it doesn't happen, and you get this borderline campy thing from Mary Lambert.
What happened to Romero's? Did it just never
– I think the timing didn't work out. It was some kind of – scheduling thing, and it ended up – Rubenstein ended up making it with Mary Lambert. Mm-hmm. So I've always been sad that we never got that. And
can you imagine?
This didn't –
George Romero's
Well,
Pet
I think
Cemetery.
It didn't edge closer.
But I think Pet Sematary for our age when it came out – I mean, I saw it. My dad took me to go see it opening night, and it worked so well for me because it was such pure horror. And as a child, I was like, oh my God. I would never want to come back as Gage.
Yeah.
You know, and then also I'm asking the exact same questions about death because death is new. You know, the concept is new. But as I got older, and I talked about this like a couple episodes back where I saw Pet Sematary Terry Cujo double feature at the Egyptian, and my opinions reversed because I never really liked Cujo. I never really got it as a kid, but now as a parent and much older, I think Cujo is an incredibly strong film.
Yes.
Yeah. Pet Sematary, I could definitely see its flaws. The flaws show, but there's still that what Mary brought to it. There's a certain what you're talking about, like a certain playfulness to the movie, and also Fred Gwynne is so good.
Yeah.
Like I remember when film school, I was like, every Oscars, I would just sit down and go, "So is Fred Gwynne winning for Pet Sematary?" And everybody's like, "Shut the fuck up." That movie was like 1989. And I was like, but I always thought he had it was a terrific performance.
Sure.
Dale Midkiff, it's Dale, right?
Dale Midkiff, yep.
He's just kind of the wet rag.
Kurt Russell wasn't available. David Keith wasn't available.
Yeah.
But I think both films.
David Keith, it's like the other Dale Midkiff.
Yeah, you know, no. A little better. The thing that both the films missed for me was the book's very adult sense of losing a child, and that dread just felt so fucking real in the book. I didn't feel it in these movies.
I think that's going to make a completely different movie, because I mean that's when you get into more of like you know, some of the heavier stuff that is about child loss, which is not going to be as commercial Stephen King, everybody in America must go see this movie type
closer
stuff.
Closer to Antichrist or Lars von Trier.
Exactly. And I mean, that's a completely – as soon as you get into the actual like emotions of losing a child, I mean, that's a bleak fucking film.
Yeah.
And it's not a fun ride, which is what – I mean, I assume that they want these movies to be is like the fun, oh, let's go see it. It's a Friday night.
More
you know, pop.
More fun like Don't Look Now. Good time.
Yeah, that is a loss of a child.
Well, yeah,
movie.
That's the whole film.
That is exactly where that
and how it blinds you to everything else. That's what's great about that film. He can't see anything else that's right in front of him because of that tragedy. But I actually did think some of that did work for me in this, especially with the father. I mean, we don't get enough of Amy. Amy has some great reactions when she first comes back, but I did see some of that loss with him and their relationship. But it maybe happens too fast that she returns, because then you don't feel the loss as much. Because
I did love
back.
The scene where he's like, I wasn't ready. When he's first trying to like soft sell it to her, I wasn't ready.
To
I
say
need
goodbye.
A little more time. And then she's starting to wig out, like, is he a grave robber? What's happening? That was a pretty good scene.
I did really like it, but it's good that we have some split votes, and Becca will weigh in soon.
Yes. I rewatched the first one last week and have to agree with Ryan that when I was a kid, that movie like fucked me up. Yeah. Like the Zelda scene, and then even Gage with the knife coming back, and I played with mommy, and now I want to – that all worked so much when I was a kid watching it. When I rewatched it, I could see the strings where I was kind of like, oh, yeah, I didn't see that when I was a kid. Or maybe I've just grown, so it just like my mental state has changed within it.
Sure. It's like tonal consistency is a bit of a problem with that one, because it goes from this one's very tonally pretty even, which is one of the improvements, I think. But
I think, you know, it's interesting because I bought the Pet Sematary 4K, which looks beautiful, and I think, you know, what that movie, you know, reminds me about, you know, that I think is missing from the new film is that there are constant reminders of death everywhere. Mm-hmm. Like Pet Sematary here is the reminder of death, whereas I feel like in the original you had I forgot about like the house cleaner or the maid or the nanny who's got suicide. Stomach cramps. Who commits suicide.
Yeah, that's a like, bleak scene.
Dark.
Super bleak. So, you know, I obviously got that. But there were like all these other layers to it that were – you just felt death everywhere. The reminder was everywhere. Whereas here I just kind of felt like it was just – there was a lot put on just the cemetery itself.
Sure.
I don't know. I miss those other layers to it.
Yeah. To Rob's point though about how the early part felt a little like box ticking, like what do you think is the secret sauce as a guy who's – revisited franchises, Ryan. What's the secret sauce to like walk through these familiar moments, right, and still somehow make them fresh? Because I did feel like the first half of this movie was like a campfire tale, or like, and this is the part where Judd shows him the cemetery. This is the part where the cat dies, and you know all of them, and even the death. It's. I feel like it probably works to a stranger, but it's playing on you thinking Gage is about to walk in front of that truck, right?
Yeah, well, that's the tricky thing, isn't it? I mean, like you really have to like in this day and age where things are being rebooted, you just it's about the kind of level of familiarity. I mean, like it's not easy for Dennis and Kevin to jump into that because one, they're playing to the crowd that's only read the book, the crowd that's read the book and seen the movie. And then to the people who have never seen it. And I feel like the first thing you really need to do is just go into it and look at all of the big emotions of Pet Sematary and take those moments and go, okay, what do I remember? And what emotions scream Pet Sematary, and what do I need to retain and carry that over into my vision of it? Mm-hmm. And then play around. Like, that's why I think that was great that they kind of played around with Ellie instead of Gage. You know?
Yeah. What did you do? But I think he's also kind of asking, like, what did you do? I don't know how much input you had when you guys were reshaping Halloween, but how much of that did you focus on when you're reading these first scripts, like playing with expectations, but also trying to give people what they want to get?
Well, it was different because it was a sequel. I mean, it was.
But it is still a feeling. You're connecting a sequel after a long fucking time.
Yeah.
And you were still evaluating, like, what's sacred? Like, what do we have to give the most respect to? The mask. Okay, well, that has to be impressive
as
shit. Yeah,
the way he walks, relationship.
Yeah, the way that he walks. Like, you knew going in.
English podcasters. You had to. You're like, I will fight for the English podcasters.
I fight for the English podcasters because podcasters is kind of my idea.
Really?
They were documentarians.
Based on the Bloodcast?
No, they were documentarians. It was like, how can we update this for 2018?
Like podcasters.
Well, once a week, I go into that conference room, and I'll tell you what I do.
But I'm not going to use that. British, English podcasters.
Yeah, why couldn't they have been American? Why you outsource our jobs? horrible shit, man.
But I have to say that I think that that there really isn't like a secret sauce, that it's going to be different for every single project, because even looking at the Suspiria remake, I mean, they didn't keep much of anything now, did they? But I mean, I know people who that was their
same
favorite
year.
Film. Yeah,
that's
the same year. Yeah, to me, there was some dance, question mark.
On no planet can you call that a remake.
Yeah.
No. Like that is just taking a title and taking a few of the concept. It feels more like all three of the Mother's films in one new vision, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's the best kind of remake, you know? That's you want a new vision, whether you like the movie or not.
Is it? Because that one I found to be really polarizing, where some – and I still don't even know what the hell I think about it, but I know some people who it was like their favorite film of the year. They thought it was brilliant. Yeah. And others who were like, I wanted Suspiria updated, and that's not it.
That would have been – like, I don't care what people think of it, because I still don't even know where I fall on the new one. Mm-hmm. I appreciated it either way, but I would have hated to see him trying to do the formal style of Argento when you're not Argento. Argento, this is a pure expression, artistic expression.
Yeah. Yeah.
To reinvent language of what a movie is. To copy that would just be such a bad move. You know?
Yeah, no, that first one, it's impossible to
remake. It's impossible, because it's just
plain and simple.
It's not – this isn't a valid thing, but – you can't make a film a la carte like that, but I walked out of Climax wondering what Gaspar Noé's Suspiria would have looked like.
Oh, yeah. Well, I
kind of wishing I had it.
I walked out just thinking, I was talking about this the other day, I just want to see him make a straight horror film. I'd love to see what he'll do. Because all the films, Into the Void, it's like, what would he do?
Yep.
I know people, this is also really polarizing. Yeah. I know people who love Climax. I was so bored. And I love
dance
movies. I told
bored.
You.
I was like, bored.
That's not the word I would use.
Okay, not bored. I wanted, it's a Gaspar Noé film. I wanted more moments where I was sitting there with my mouth agape, not believing that I could actually be seeing this. Opening dance scene was cool. There was some really cool photography in it. Yeah. But as soon as it became, we're just running around following various people as, you know, I'm going to go to this person and shave my head. Now I'm going to go over here and scream at this person. And, oh, look, she's peeing. And now we're following this person as she goes over here and humps a wall. I was just kind of like, how long is this going
to
go on?
Is the girl with hair on fire? No, I agree with you in the sense.
Did you forget to drop acid before you watched it like
everyone else? I didn't. I was definitely going in.
It has no narrative thread to pull you through to care about anyone. But that's also what's so fascinating about it. It doesn't mean it's good for the film. I agree with you in some ways. I really like it. I fail to love it because there's no one to love.
That was
you can love the form, but you can't love anyone.
And most of the Gaspar Noé films, I go in going like, holy shit, I'm going to see some batshit crazy. And there was a couple of moments where I was like, okay, well, I guess that was daring.
He's a surprisingly emotional filmmaker. It seems cold and Kubrickian from the outside, but Irreversible has got a lot of heart. Mm-hmm. It's a very upsetting movie because you care by the end. And Enter the Void, I think, similar.
Same.
I think you can care a lot about things.
I did not leave this movie caring or upset.
Yeah.
So whereas most of the Gaspar Noé films, I go through some type of cathartic thing while I'm watching it where I leave feeling like I've watched an episode of Black Mirror where I'm like emotionally drained and like, why do I even bother going on with everything?
Right.
This one I left going, well, that was a thing.
Yeah.
And that's like all I had at
but
the
you get
end,
3.5 stars for referencing position. Boom. Good stuff, Gaspar. You got it.
One of the things, just to wrap the Pet Sematary stuff up, can we stop calling?
I love that we were talking about that.
Yeah.
Wait, weren't we on Bond?
You were on Bond and Climax, but I want to bring it back really quick because I keep seeing remake.
Yeah.
Pop up when people talk about Pet Sematary. And I feel like we should throw that word out the window when you're talking about directors coming to the table readapting a novel.
Mm.
You know, I feel like that puts a lot of pressure. Mm.
Yeah. That's not a marketable term, Ryan.
Fuck it.
But I mean, but when you have the same characters, it is still a reading.
What are you talking about? They're in a book.
Yeah, no, but
they're coming.
You're not remaking the movie. You're remaking
readapting the book.
You're readapting the book.
The movie already exists in the zeitgeist, so you can't. It's impossible to divorce yourself.
I'm
looking for change, Elric. I want change.
Well, I'm against this change.
Well, that was when Carrie with Chloe Moretz was coming out. I had heard through the grapevine that they were going back to the book. It was going to be like interviews with the kids, and I was like, "Oh, cool! It's a new adaptation." And I stopped using the word like remake when I talked about Carrie. Then I saw Carrie, and I went, "This is a remake."
Yeah,
what the fuck?
Well, you.
I think you answered. You know, you just said what I was thinking is that in some cases, yes, something is a readaptation.
Yes,
but sometimes it's completely in conversation with the original film, and there's no getting around it. Yeah. I don't know that Pet Sematary acquitted itself of that label necessarily.
It's playing on your knowledge of the first movie so much.
Yeah,
quite
that's
a bit.
Super important.
But
the first
to Ryan's point, it's also in the book.
I feel like in one scene, yes.
A couple. Anything with Zelda, anything with the slashing of certain body parts. That was huge. And gay.
Well, I was talking about I'm talking about the slash.
But all three of those moments, like the fun of it is, it wouldn't be as fun if you hadn't seen the first film.
Yeah.
Like that was the fun part for me. It's like, oh, they're not going to do it. Oh, they did it. You know, that kind of feeling.
Zelda being in the same exact color nightgown that she was in the first film.
Sure.
Sort of winks toward the remake end of things.
Yeah.
The only other thing I was trying to think of in terms of a thematics is that they had really brought to the table and shifted is that like Dennis and Kevin are kind of hipster city folk, seem to have made this film. I love them.
We love you both. We love you guys.
Yeah, I love
them. He said you guys are hip.
They're hipster city folk. They know. But they made a film where over and over everybody's like, we shouldn't have left the city. We shouldn't have left the city. We shouldn't have left the city. Right. And they all end up as soulless zombies. Yeah. Living in the burbs at the end. Yeah. And I kind of wonder like if Kevin Kolsch is taking a swipe at the burbs.
Could be.
That was the meaning of the whole film.
It might have been.
Hulu Into the Dark. I saw one of the new ones.
Oh, yes.
April Fool's Day one called I'm Just Fucking With You. And I haven't seen all of these. I've seen a couple. This was definitely my favorite. I think the main actor – he's not the lead, but he's the guy who's fucking with you. Chester by a guy called Hayes MacArthur. It's a great performance. This kind of has the dark humor of a cheap thrills type vibe. You know, and again, sometimes I feel like these could be an hour versus an hour and a half or 90 minutes just because of the nature of the kind of teleplay styles of some of these. Mm-hmm. But it really is fun. And the guy, the lead guy, is such an asshole. He's like the modern man who's basically cyber trolling his ex-girlfriend he's on his way to her wedding, and he's just basically got an alias, and he is just the nastiest piece of work. And probably there's people listening who might do this exact thing. I have no idea online, but it's just – it's so evil. And so it's what's interesting is you have two characters who you can't really like either of them. You end up liking the antagonist a bit more just because he's funny. Yeah. But it is fun. So it's set on April Fool's Day, and he's at a motel, and he checks into this motel where this guy has taken over the motel, you know, seemingly like he runs the motel, and everything is a joke to this guy and an increasingly bad joke throughout the night that's messing with this other character's life and slowly forcing him to confront who he really is, which is the interesting part of it. It's a good teleplay. Like it when is. You look at how the growth of two characters, but I had fun with it.
And also it's shot like
Drive straight, or something.
No. It's shot like the pool scene from Strangers.
Yeah, exactly. It's almost
the entire movie.
Yeah, neon aesthetic.
But yeah, it's one of those movies that I didn't have anything to do with. It was our TV department that was making it. So I kind of went in cold and I watched it over the weekend like you. And I was just, Adam Mason, I thought, did a really good job with it.
It's pretty tight.
And Chino Moreno from Deftones did the soundtrack.
Hey, who plays the sister? She was really good too. I didn't get her name.
I think she's an Australian actress.
She's somebody I recognize, but the main guy to me, this is like one of those star turns where you notice an actor suddenly and go, oh yeah, who's that guy? Because he's going to do stuff.
Hayes MacArthur?
Yeah, Hayes MacArthur.
Yeah. He's very good.
He was in Director's Cut, Adam Rifkin's movie.
Oh.
And he's an excellent asshole in a previous Adam Rifkin movie called Look.
Oh, yeah, I remember that movie.
He's like the store clerk doing some activity at the store in front of the cameras.
But I liked that for April Fool's Day. I thought it was fun, a fun version on that.
That's cool.
I thought it was cool.
All right.
Yeah. Rob G.
Since it's actually perfect timing that Phil is here because we want to discuss something that is genre adjacent. A lot of people are looking forward to the follow-up to It Follows.
Wait, not the pig fucking movie?
Not the pig fucking movie.
We'll save that
for Chattanooga. But we're talking about Under the Silver Lake, which is why am I drawing a blank on his name?
David Robert Mitchell.
And this – actually, it's ironic because I got this Blu-ray from my fiance from France, in turn tweeted to Phil, who immediately bought the French version as well.
Yes.
And of course, they now announced A24 that they will release it on VOD the 22nd of this month. So it's actually finally coming out unceremoniously just on VOD. It'd be great if somebody showed it on the big screen. It's tough because it's a 2.5 hour movie.
Yeah.
We'll
get it.
Yes.
Yeah, it's 2.5 hours?
Yeah, no, that was easily. I think that was a big part of it.
Here's where we'll start, Ryan.
Well, let's start with the trailer because the trailer looked tight. A tight fucking mystery, Lynchian mystery. And I remember going, oh my God, I cannot wait to see this movie because it was just ticking all my boxes.
Let me pour some tea and sit back and listen
to this.
But then
I
remember it played in competition at Cannes.
Yeah.
I think it was the only American film in competition at Cannes, which just tells you what his reputation was at post It Follows. And then I remember it played at Cannes and there was like silence. And usually, you know, you're expecting to hear lots of stuff and then there's silence and then there's a lot of rumors about recutting. And then suddenly the date kept getting pushed by A24 on this release. And I thought that was a travesty. Without having seen the movie, I was like, I cannot believe they would do this. And you get all fired up because you don't know what the hell you're talking about.
Yeah.
So as we get into the movie, regardless, all I'll say up front before we talk about the movie itself is watching the movie halfway through is one of the first times I've ever had this in my entire life. I was sitting there with the exec suddenly hat on going, oh, yeah, I totally would have shelved this movie. it was such a weird feeling. I was like, no, I'm enjoying it. But I totally understand why I would not have put this in theaters.
Because we definitely liked it.
Yeah.
And we were enjoying it. But
and the first 30 or 40 minutes, it's awesome. You're right into it.
The whole idea – like basically the only thing I'll tell you, which is from the first 30 minutes, is basically Andrew Garfield, who's fucking fearless in this movie.
Crazy
fearless, all the stuff he does, including his Spider-Man gag, which I laughed out loud at.
Sure.
But anyway, he's kind of like this – I don't know what his deal is. You don't really know.
Okay.
unemployed hipster.
Unemployed hipster. Kinda
slacker, Lebowski.
Slacker. Yeah. You know, kind of likes the girl in his complex. Ends up by fate kind of running into her and hanging out with her for
the
night.
We called it straight away. We're saying hipster Hitchcock.
I called it hipster Hitchcock.
Because it has a lot of Hitchcock
references. The score is like.
I'm watching Phil's reactions.
Yeah.
But it's a very 1940s score.
Yes.
Which is amazing.
By Disaster Piecer.
When it's not.
Which is crazy, yeah.
When it's not diegetic music from this band that features in the film. This fictional band called Jesus and the Brides of Dracula.
They're awesome. Yeah.
Yes. Oh. Yes.
Yeah.
I'm listening.
Yeah.
And it's catchy. Those songs will get in your head.
Those songs are good.
So you said you don't know what his deal is. Here's how I described it to somebody. So you know how Big Lebowski is Raymond Chandler, but he's a stoner. This is Raymond Chandler, but he's kind of got schizophrenia and he also might be an ass freak. Or
wait, what's an ass freak?
It's someone who's really into asses.
Okay.
Yeah, an ass man.
That makes sense, given his sexual proclivities in the film.
Every shot is – if there's an ass in that shot, that ass is framed very particularly.
Could be the director is
that. That's the dilemma. Is the character an ass freak or is the director an ass freak? Yeah. Or is it one and the same?
But he's definitely – there's definitely purposeful homages. Obviously, it's Rear Window from the get-go, but it's – like there's posters of Hitchcock all on the walls.
Yeah, yeah.
The score is totally emulating Hitchcock. Yeah,
stuff like that.
Okay.
There's a lot going on.
So aside the fact that it's got like Tinto Brass-ish like ass play in it, why has this movie not come out here?
Okay.
Because it's
unmarketable.
Yeah.
So you said
the trailer was definitely marketable.
You said
right out of Cannes, the
story became, oh, they're going to cut it. So that narrative takes hold. And so when I was at Fantasia on a jury, by the way, film festival juries are total scams. You get no free time. You get nothing to do. Mm. But I made time to go see Under the Silver Lake because it was under threat of never being able to see this cut again. Yeah. Saw it. Never knew what was going to happen next. B, couldn't wait to see what was going to happen next.
You couldn't predict that was, 10 minutes in the future.
That was my thing.
There was a moment. Was it 2 hours in? Like, we were like, because it's 2.5 hours. At the 2 hour mark, we looked to see how much more time was left. And me and Auger were like, I have no idea.
It felt like they had wrapped up the whole narrative, and then there's another whole narrative added, and you're like, holy shit.
But not in a fatiguing way.
Not really, no.
I didn't
think. It's very entertaining. But there's a lot of storylines going on simultaneously that sort of connect, and that's the thing. It's like, I think you were saying like, oh, I just watched like, I watched David's seven new movies.
Well, that's,
Elric texted me that night, and I was like, what was it like? And he was like, Southland Tales?
With a lot of, but it's not like that.
But I like Southland Tales, so I was like,
I like this more than Southland Tales.
Yeah,
for me
too.
I need to rewatch Southland Tales, but my first was like, I just don't get it. I get more, but there's a lot in there.
Yes. I enjoy for the several Kurt Cobain references, which are all hilarious in my opinion. But this is kind of exactly said like Richard Kelly from Donnie Darko to Southland Tales.
Same kind of trick,
Girl Who Walks Alone.
Bad Batch.
Basically, it's like, hey, I made a movie and now I'm going to do whatever the hell I want in this next one.
Yeah.
And I don't know. Basically, we were kind of like, is this a satire on hipster culture or
just indulging in it. It's somewhere between. But there are horror sequences, and that's the one thing, and they're really good. Every time he touches on a horror trope, he does it so well that you're reminded, like, this guy can make horror films.
The craft is always there.
Yeah,
100%.
It's an unwieldy film, and I want to meet the guy who said – who watched that cut and said, I can fix this.
Yeah.
Like if there was ever a conversation about cutting it down, I want to know what exactly he thought he was going to do.
But they also greenlit the script.
Yeah.
And so to not want to put out the movie at 2.5, you're like, you guys would have known this on the screen. It would have been even less – it would have made less sense on the page because it's just so unwieldy, the concepts.
Was the Blu-ray the same cut that you saw at the festival?
Same cut.
Okay, great.
Because I also saw it at Fantastic Fest because once again they were like, oh, they cut it. And then I'm like, oh, let me see what they changed. They didn't change anything. And then the Blu-ray happened, and yeah, and I watched it like the day it came. And I don't do that with Blu-rays, as you know.
Yeah. Guys, this is my favorite review. I'm reading all the reviews on IMDb right now. If Mulholland Drive were written by a ninth grader.
I mean a talented ninth grader.
Yes.
Well, actually.
And this review mentions
the best thing
Southland
in this movie
Tales
is that a ninth grader gets punched in the gut. That's my favorite moment in cinema.
Child violence is a big thumbs up for me.
Some kids are egging cars.
But on the plus side, the fact that this is getting shelved means we might get an It Follows 2 from him. Maybe he'll have to retreat back into sequel mode, and I'm all about it.
Oh my gosh.
Now's the time to get him, Ryan.
Wow.
I would love to actually have him as a guest on a show. I think it'd be phenomenal to get to talk about this movie in depth. And
actually, I would love, because everything I'm reading, it's either 10 stars or 1 star.
I think Becca would actually really like this movie a lot.
If I don't know what's going on,
I'm definitely going to see it.
I think Ryan would like sequences a lot.
Yeah.
I want to see what he's up to. I love It Follows.
I do too. I think it's one of the best.
Rob, this is you don't know about this about me, but it's a secret power that I have. When I buy a weird import thing, I do that to sort of open the floodgates, and that's why it's hitting.
That's why,
pretty much.
I have picked on that. You buy something, you're like, oh, now it's finally going to come out officially.
Bought the Martin Blu-ray from Japan, and 11 days later,
I saw that
11 days, I was like, it's my new personal best. You're welcome, everyone.
We had to bump up our score, because we were like, oh, when can we watch this? And then as soon as we heard that it was coming out of view, it was like, we have to watch this Blu-ray
right
away.
We want to feel special still.
So.
But it's
recommend?
Utterly fascinating.
I'm adding it to my Amazon order right now. I have to do the
French
one,
right? I think you have to watch it. I mean, if you like to follow
it. It comes out on VOD on the 22nd here.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
they just announced it.
Hold on there, Becca.
Okay.
Hold on.
I will say it's one of the best shot LA movies in a long time in terms of geography. Mm, you're going to see a lot. It's going to be the LA. Silver Lake. It's all around here. You're just watching this movie go, oh, weird. He's really paying attention to the geography. But it also just keeps going. And then there keeps new storylines where you're like, oh, my God, this mystery angle is, it's strange.
My fiance is like, can you take me to those places? I'm like, yes, we can go to Intelligentsia and Silver Lake.
Sunset Junction.
Is it that exciting?
If you've ever read any first-person stuff by someone who suffers from schizophrenia and the way that they sort of see words and patterns and things, it sort of very much taps into that and gives you like the most unreliable protagonist.
Yeah.
But maybe he's onto something, but maybe he's not, kind of thing. And I was just all in on it. I really loved it.
Yeah.
No, that's why I was really happy that you happened to be coming on right after we started, because you were one of the few people I knew who had seen it and liked it. So most people haven't even seen it.
Yeah,
so.
It's full of great character actors with like almost walk-on parts.
Yeah.
There's so much. I just
we were trying to,
watch.
To figure out, and this isn't a spoiler because they won't know what we're talking about, but the music guy, that's all I'll say. Do you know who that actor was?
It's not anybody. There's no reason for him to look
I kept thinking, is that Bruce Campbell or somebody surprising under makeup? No?
Yeah, there's a fascinating scene that just is kind of out of context, would be just an amazing scene about
just
a music producer. Sure. And it's very obviously somebody in old age makeup. Like, it's like not even, like, it's obvious.
Well, it's like Bruce and Bubba
Hotep.
Yeah,
so you look
that's
at it and you're like, who is that? Who is that? And and there's no credits anywhere online or anything like that. So you're like, is it a secret cameo? But I actually kind of like that you're like, nope, nobody.
Yeah.
Even better.
It's like Tilda Swinton, Suspiria level shit.
Oh, no way.
Yeah.
Does it have like a little baby arm? Does he have a baby arm coming out?
No, not that one. The other one. The old psychiatrist. That would have been something.
Okay. Well, I'll talk about this one because whereas that one had like 7 different plots, this one has 1, and there isn't even a beeline or anything like that. So I watched The Headhunter,
and I'm
throwing pens. Sorry about that. I'll pick it back up. So I watched The Headhunter. This one had been recommended to me by a couple people, and I was a little nervous at first to watch it because this is directed by Jordan Downey, and his prior claim to fame was Thanksgiving and Thanksgiving 3, which were definitely fun, but not me. And so when people are like,
but now they can put on their cover, it's fun, Rebecca McKendry.
Not me. But people kept recommending this to me saying, oh no, you're going to love this. This is absolutely amazing. The gore is really, tight and it's super small. And I loved this movie. And it's another one that's been really polarizing online, but a lot of people are finding it shot for like $30,000. The plot is, and it's so simplistic, but it's a medieval warrior. You don't know what time it is. You just know it's medieval and that there's something kind of supernatural because there's all these creatures in the world.
But
all
you do
of
not
these
think when you say 30
creatures.
Grand budget, you don't think medieval style.
No.
Movie.
Yeah. And it feels huge in that regard. Like, and that's what some of the people online or that I've been talking to are like, I did not feel the low budget in this. The only place that you feel it is that it's one actor. The entire fucking movie. Because how he ends up by himself is the catalyst. He is with his daughter. You see that he's like this crazy medieval like Viking warrior who's all bloody and clearly been in battle. And then he walks into a tent and his daughter is there sleeping. And then you realize that throughout that night, this creature kills her. And then the rest of the movie is him by himself in a shack trying to get revenge on this creature, trying to hunt and kill this creature. And it's in there's a lot of, I'll call it kind of alchemy-ish stuff where he's taking heads from other creatures and he's doing something where he's breaking them down and makes this black tar that seems to heal his wounds. So you're watching a lot of him do metal work and things like that and hunt. And it's brutal and gory and just him. They filmed it. I looked it up because I was so intrigued. They filmed it in a 500-year-old mill that was used for grinding like flour and stuff, used for grinding grain. And it's just this beautiful scenery. It's all of this gorgeous woods around him and hyper gore as he's like trying to hunt down these creatures and being attacked by other things in the process.
Where'd you see it? It's on.
It's on. I saw a screening link, but I believe it's on Amazon and iTunes. Yeah. Super, super small. Literally this one guy the whole time. And the only other time that I had seen one movie, a movie where it was just one person the whole time was The Last Will and Testament of Rosalind Lee. Do you guys remember that?
Yeah, I remember the guy who did Rue Morgue magazine,
yep.
The editor
and
that went on to direct.
That was a guy by himself in his dead mom's house. Mm-hmm. And some of that
was interesting.
That had a couple people that came in at the end. And there was parts of it that worked. And I was always kind of inspired by the, can you make a movie with just one actor? This one was so captivating for me. And I'm seeing a lot of people online that are like, oh God, this was so boring. It was just one dude. Nothing happened. It was just him hunting a creature the whole time. But that's what I was into. And it is super, super gory. All of the effects were done by Jordan Downey, the same guy who directed it. So if he did this for $30,000, I'm really excited to see where he can go from here. Like, Thanksgiving, not my jam. This, I fucking loved.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got to see it.
Yeah, it's. I mean, it's slow paced. It's a burn, but I was in.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Where did you say it was available?
iTunes and Amazon.
Okay, yeah.
And it's the Headhunter.
The Headhunter. Yes.
Yeah. Film I revisited over the weekend because it's got a glorious new Blu-ray presentation, 3-disc set is Dario Argento's Opera.
Ooh. Nice.
Oh, you got the fancy set.
I got that one too.
I got the fancy set. This is just to put it in context for y'all. This is my third favorite Argento film.
Wow.
Nice. First is Tenebrae, second is Suspiria, Opera is third. And I think it just kind of plays to those, you know, those slasher beats that I love so much. Mm-hmm. But if you haven't seen Opera, it's basically it's basically set in and around an opera house where a young woman has been escalated to the lead of an opera because the former lead actress got hit by a car and she's been laid up. And as this woman is going through the experience of rehearsals, there is a killer taking out particular crew members. And it is the first film you'll probably ever see in which some crows are murdered. And later the crows are used to identify the killer. Wow. Because crows have a terrific sense of memory and identifying people.
Wow.
Great POV crow shot.
The great POV crow shot plays in line with just the beautiful camera work of our opera.
It's a beautiful – it's definitely his best last movie. It's a glorious –
yeah. It's – well, there's urgency to every shot. The camera's constantly roving through hallways playing as a POV or you're just a fly on the wall. It kind of straddles a line between – being shot naturalistically and being shot like, you know, like Suspiria. There's a lot of beautiful color, but there's a lot of realism brought into it.
Is this the one with the underwater sequence, or is that Inferno?
That's Inferno. Inferno's amazing.
It's been many years.
We saw Inferno not long ago. and it plays great. But the thing about Opera, and I think what he kind of starts to lose, there's still moments in some of his movies, but like when you capture an image that you'll never forget, like seeing her eyes opened with the razor blades. These are images that you can never get out of your shake, or that, or even the crow flying through.
Well,
the
it's
one
also
take.
You know, it's Daria looking through the keyhole, and then the killer putting a gun at the keyhole. Yeah. All of a sudden, the bullet goes flying, you know, in slow mo through the keyhole of through the hole of the door, and then through her head. You know, it's like,
and then he does something like that in Stendhal too. I can't remember. Like
he does. Yeah.
I haven't seen the Blu-ray of this. I haven't seen this in about 10 years. Oh, so, but I've got the other Blu-ray. Yeah. I have to watch it.
But I remember also. I remember seeing. I think was at a Fangoria Weekend of Horrors or something, and they were doing like a Best of Argento sizzle reel, and they played this, and it was like. The girl running through the, you know, this beautiful field, I think in Switzerland or something. And she's almost like wearing like a Sound of Music dress. And I remember watching it completely out of context. And I was like, wow, this is really beautiful. And the music's suspenseful. And all of a sudden, it just goes full heavy metal. And the audience just went nuts. And I was like, I really need to know what this movie is. And I can't believe they threw the sizzle reel. How could the person throw heavy metal on it? You know, that's so amazing. And then I realized it's actually in the film.
Yeah.
They actually throw – it's like – it's very schizophrenic in the sense that you get a beautiful soundtrack, but then during the murder sequences, they just go full metal. But it's just a it's a great whodunit kind of thriller. There's a sense of humor that I love. You know, the you know, it plays into like the kind of black glove killer aesthetic. Mm-hmm. The thing – about opera is that it completely falls apart in the last 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Once the killer is revealed, once you get his motivations, a lot of kind of fever dream-esque sequences that Dario, you know, scattered throughout the film that you were kind of like, okay, what the hell am I looking at? Why am I looking at a close-up of a fevered brain? You're literally looking at a brain pulsing. It all comes to fruition. You kind of understand why. But it doesn't make any fucking sense.
Yeah,
it's
he's best out of the realm of logic, I think. Yeah. Like his best work, but
well, he teams up with Franco Farini, who wrote Demons, and you know he's an artist. He was part of Stendhal Syndrome and The Card Player and all that stuff. But I really, really fucking enjoy opera. I mean, like I'm willing to forgive the batshit ending, crazy ending that doesn't make sense. You know, for everything else. So,
all right, hold
when was the last time you saw it, Phil?
What was the last opera, time? Opera? Oh, probably VHS.
No.
Oh,
wow.
You got to check out revisit. This Blu-ray.
Yeah. But there's some terrific terrific interviews. There's tons of interviews on there.
What's the deal? Why the three discs?
A lot of them is brand new. Well, there's three versions of the movie on there. I don't even know which one to go here.
There's the studio cut that was released in the U.S.
Yeah.
There is the – I watched –
there's two different panned
versions. I watched the 2:35:1. I watched that version. Mm. And then there's another version. I don't know what it was. But there's
I don't like
just
having
so
choices.
Yeah.
I just want the good one.
Usually disc one is right. I guess that's the main version of the movie.
It pause. It definitely gave me pause because I was like, which one do I watch? I didn't realize. But I spent the night watching some of the bonus features. The Dario interview is very good.
And they're all new. It's like a brand new Dario interview.
The Coralina Cataldi
is brand new as
well. Let me just say, Coralina Cataldi is one of the nicest people I have ever interacted.
Well, I have a story about her.
I was going to say, when we the Fango office in New York, every holiday she would bring us something. Oh. She would just show up and she'd be like, I brought you guys all pumpkins. I brought you guys all Christmas candy. And it was amazing. Oh. And that's how I got to know her. And we're still like friends on Facebook and everything.
That's
but
awesome.
She was just always so sweet.
I had met her just maybe like once or twice before. This is like when I returned to LA back in like 2005, 2006. And then when I was in the hospital for a week period because of a collapsed lung. And I remember that was like during a Fango Weekend of Horrors convention. And I'm like in the hospital bed, like wondering, oh my God, am I going to have a stroke because I'm not getting enough air? And there's a knock at the door and Coralina comes in. She goes, Ryan, I heard you're in the hospital here. I brought you a signed autograph and all these other things. And I was like, this is the sweetest fucking thing
That's
ever.
Amazing.
It was amazing. I'll never, ever forget
Very
that.
Very cool.
She was super cool. And the interview that she does is fantastic.
Yeah, it's like at a cafe in New York while it's raining.
Well, it's pouring rain.
I just love that stuff.
Oh, that's cool.
You know? Yeah.
Okay, guys, hold on to your hat. This is an amazing movie. From the listener who brought Amsterdam to us,
Ooh.
Jacob Saman.
Thank you for that, by the way.
Yes, thank you. He was – before it got the nice restoration, he had written to me and I think he just sent me a DVD and he's like, you got to see this movie.
Amsterdam.
So he wrote to me again. So this is only the second time he's written to me in this period. He's like, oh my God, you've got to see this movie. This is how I pitched it to me. He goes, it starts Die Hard. It becomes Indiana Jones, and then it goes brain damage. And I was like, whoa. And then I looked up the cover art, and it has Chow Yun-Fat and Maggie Cheung, which must be her first role because she's a kid.
Wait, what is this?
This movie.
If it goes full Hennenlotter, I am
ready.
So in.
You're about to get so much more in when I tell you who directed this movie from the director of motherfucking Story of Ricky O.
Whoa.
What?
And it is
oh
in the
God.
Same wavelength yes. as Ricky O. The movie is called.
It?
And best of all, it's on Amazon Prime right now.
What
it's
the
called,
fuck is it called?
The Seventh Curse.
Nice.
Okay. I love it when people want to know the title to a title they'll never have heard of anyway, so who cares? Yeah.
No,
anyway.
But I'm literally sitting goes, here okay. on Amazon to queue it up.
So I watched it last night because he broke to me a couple days ago, and I was like, okay, I got to watch this before. Chow Yun-Fat's a small role, but you know, I'm watching this movie. When he pops up, he should be the next James fucking Bond. Chow Yun-Fat is the smoothest man on earth, in my opinion. Anyway, the movie, I don't even think if you paid me $100 right now, I could recount any of the plot. All I'll tell you is it basically opens in a Die Hard thing where there's some people, or more like a hard-boiled situation where there's some people in this building being held hostage. We have to go in. It's just a police procedural action thing. You have to go in there and put a bomb, and you're like, what is this movie? And it's not great, the opening. And I was like, okay, but I know he promised me they're saying here. And then after that part kind of settles down, they go, you know, you can't have sex, remember, because of that blood curse last year. And he goes, oh, that's right, the blood curse. And then the flashback happens. Suddenly yes. It's Indiana Jones. You're in the jungle. There's this
bloodthirsty
weird cult.
Creatures, according yes. to the log line.
So
I'm
there's
reading.
This crazy, cruel cult that this group of, I guess, anthropologists go into study, and you meet the leader who's like a cult leader who looks really evil and has this high-pitched effeminate voice, which is like laugh out loud funny. But in the middle of the this guy is talking to his people, and one of them crosses him about the gods that he's going to sacrifice. And out of nowhere, under his dress or something, he pulls basically a total Hennenlotter baby thing that just comes out, eats the person from the inside, blood goes everywhere. It's like the most Hennenlotter creature I've seen outside of a Hennenlotter film.
Wow.
It's fucking awesome. And wow. You're suddenly like, okay, whatever this movie is, just count me in. I'm going to watch the rest of the
yes.
– it'll cut back to Chow Yun-Fat back in the city. You know, he's Mr. Cool. I don't even know what his job is, but he's the guy you know is going to come in
just,
the last
hold
act.
Hold on. It just said – No, never mind. Old school Mr. Wisely and Dr. Yoon dueling in a battle against evil sorcerers, bloodthirsty creatures to release the blood curse.
Yeah, there's blood curse stuff, but in the, there is a part where this like old skeleton thing, it reminds me almost of something out from like I don't know, you know, Big Trouble Little China almost, but it's like this like corpse thing that doesn't look like a very good corpse. It's pretty cheap, but it just keeps going after them and like then rips somebody's head off. And if you're familiar, I talked about on Pure Cinema, I think Becca talked about it here, Story of Ricky, the payoff of that is if somebody punches someone in the stomach, it goes right
it goes
through
all the, way
the
through.
Stomach, and the gore effects are just incredible. This has that same energy. You would definitely know it's the same director.
Wow.
It made me realize I have to see more films by this guy. But the best part is it's just on Amazon Prime for free, and you just push play and go, what is this craziness?
Nice.
I don't think I can do much more to the plot, but it was a fun ride.
Already sold.
Story of Ricky like works maybe a little better because it's just there's one protagonist. There's multiple weird characters in this. I really don't even know what the point of this is, but man, are you going to have fun. And that's all you have to have.
Excellent. Yeah.
That's
time.
The seventh curse.
Seventh curse. And Maggie Cheung, it took me a while because I had just shown my students that day In the Mood for Love, which is her as a 40-year-old.
Yeah.
And she's just incredible in that film. And she's matured so much as an actor. In this, she must be like 18. And she's like this annoying kid with a high-pitched voice. And you're like, it's amazing the growth she had, you know, between these two roles. So,
yeah.
Anyway, cool film.
Cool.
Cool. I watched one from Vinegar Syndrome. It's called Psychos in Love from 1987, and it's directed by Gorman Bouchard, who also did
Disconnected,
another classic. This is actually after Disconnected, and it's much, much better. It's just – it's really – when the guys were on the show talking about some of their catalog stuff, I think he just said this was – I can't remember what he described it. He was like, this is like the romantic one you could watch with your wife. It's an okay – and you know, I don't know how if a lot of Vinegar Syndrome stuff fits that bill, but I trusted him, and so I put it on, and it is. It's more of a quirky heart comedy more than anything because basically it's this very Italian guy played by Carmine Cavabianco. He plays Joe, and he's basically like looking at camera, kind of giving his whole story about meeting the right person. And he's like, and I have this problem. I'm a serial killer. I don't get along with them, and you know, that's it. And so basically, like, you see him like hooking up with like these wonderful women and then just killing them, being like, yeah, she didn't work out either. And then another one, he's like, this is the girl of my dreams for sure, blah, blah, blah. And then she mentions something that she loves grapes. And he's like, I hate grapes. No grapes. And so basically he kills her in the shower, psycho style because of that. And then it cuts to a girl doing the same thing, talking to camera, saying like, oh yeah, I can't really find a good guy, and also I'm a serial killer. And then we kind of go in these like really funny set pieces of her taking out some guys after dates. She's like a manicurist, so it's usually during while she's giving them a manicure. And basically by fate, Joe's a bartender. He meets this other girl who is it Kate or Diane? I think it's Diane. Kate. And basically they hit it off right away. He asks her right away, like, do you like grapes? She's like, I fucking hate grapes. It's like, okay.
It's a thing.
I mean, it's really, it's funny in that way. And then basically he's like, all right, well, look, I guess I should tell you that I'm a serial killer. She's like, oh my God, me too. And so it's just this quirky kind of funny comedy about two serial killers finding each other. And Vinny
so American put, Psycho, if he met his match, like Bride of American Psycho,
but much sillier. Hmm. It's definitely. But what's funny is there are good gore gags. Like it has that early '80s aesthetic of like kind of doing like fun, creative kills. But it's done in such a weird, over the top, comical way that it's just fun. And I thought it was really funny. Vinegar Syndrome did a great job on the disc. There's some interviews and stuff on there. But it's also on Amazon Prime right now. So
cool.
And from what I understand, the Amazon Prime stuff is the Vinegar Syndrome scans, I believe. Nice. I can't confirm. So it'll probably look really good on Amazon Prime as well.
I want Shudder to make friends with Vinegar so they can stream all their films, because they are the kind of films I don't always want to buy first.
I think Vinegar has a relationship with Amazon Prime because a lot of their titles are on there. Okay. So I would check there first. But Psycho's in Love, I think if you're just looking for something kind of fun from the 80s that's just ridiculous, it's a good one.
That is one of the ones they highlighted on the show.
Yeah.
Trust them,
There's something hitting Netflix next month, and I think it played some festivals, but it's called The Perfection.
Mm-hmm.
Have you guys seen this yet?
No.
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, Ryan's laughing.
Why are you laughing?
I've seen The Perfection because it is – it's perhaps the most insane film you'll probably get this year.
What? All right, there you go. I don't even know what I need to add to that.
Go watch Seventh Curse, and then we'll have a conversation.
I don't know. That's a good thing, though.
Is this the same one I'm looking at about a cello player?
Yes.
Okay.
It's about a cello player who
Allison Williams, isn't it?
She's the Allison Williams, and she leaves this. She leaves this music conservatory to take care of her dying mother. And then she comes back. And to tell you – to even tell you what subgenres it sort of reclaims would spoil it. But it is it's gory. There's body horror. It's another movie where you're not sure what's going to happen next, but you can't wait to see what's going to happen next. And it takes some really audacious turns.
Yeah. Coming
and
to Netflix.
Audacious is right. Yeah. It's an incredibly outrageous film.
It's bonkers.
Wow.
Okay.
And
They played a fantastic fest last year.
Right, and I missed it.
Yeah. And you'll see Allison Williams in a role that you did not expect. This is the actress from Get Out, and she was on Girls.
Yes. And she's
and
very
Steven
much,
Weber.
She's very much playing on her newfound rep post Get Out, I think, in this movie. But not in the most obvious ways. Mm. It's a two-woman show, essentially. Mm. It's different. It's funny. It knocked me out. I don't know.
I want to have a new segment to the show called Coming Attractions, where Phil just like pops in and goes, well, in 2 weeks on Netflix.
Oh, I don't know how you schedule
it. I'm all about it.
Like, I don't know when this is going live. Maybe it's up by then. Who knows?
No. Friday. Yeah.
Friday. No.
Oh, is it this
You're
Friday?
Wait a little longer.
This Friday.
No, I'm saying it's
Friday.
Not by the time the correction comes out. It'll be out. But,
sorry.
No. It's it's bananas.
Yeah.
Okay. Ball bonkers. I mean, like, it really is bonkers.
It doesn't look bonkers.
No. Yeah. I read it and then I looked at the pictures and I was kind of like, oh, it looks dry.
I wanted to hold on talking about it because, I caught it at a Fantastic Fest and I wanted to hold on talking about it because I had not had a home yet.
I'd worried that you'd already talked about it.
No.
You guys had already seen it.
No.
It's like 86 minutes.
Come back from Fest and mention some.
Some that I know that I've already either found homes or done. But
when do we get The Lodge? That's the one I want to see most.
Mm-hmm.
The Lodge, Neon's got it, so it'll be later this year.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's the one I want to see.
I just want to mention something that I'm listening to in audiobook form. If you remember, I was reading The Con Season by Adam Caesar. I'm listening to Stephen Graham Jones's novel, The Last Final Girl, which is kind of like a tongue-in-cheek, Scream-esque slasher book, but it's, I'm kind of like in the opening hour of it, and within that hour I've gotten a slasher who dresses up like Michael Jackson wearing the Billie Jean outfit from the music video, And it's the first time I've ever heard of a slasher taking on a horse.
Yeah.
A horse. Do they fight back?
The horse is defending the final girl.
Oh, I didn't know they did that.
Yeah, so it was her horse, and then he.
Is this my attack horse?
This is my attack horse, and the horse tries to defend her, but the slasher takes it on. It winds up knocking out the horse's eyes. The horse lives, thankfully. He's blinded in this altercation, but the slasher goes down. But I'm very curious to see where it goes. It's very funny, actually. And I'm looking at Amazon, and they describe it as like Cabin in the Woods meets Quentin Tarantino, which is pretty accurate.
Nice.
So Stephen Graham Jones, the last final girl.
Wow.
Yeah.
I watched Mercy Black, which was the one that released to Netflix last week. It was kind of the big release. And I watched this. I didn't know it had released, but my students, specifically my freshman film students, were like freaking out about this. Like, oh my God,
that's
it's amazing.
Great.
You have to watch it.
That's great.
They absolutely loved it. It definitely, so Ryan's an EP on it, yeah. I noticed in the opening credits.
That's part of the development team. Yes.
Yeah. So it definitely is using, I'm saying borrows is a more polite word, from the Slender Man mythos, where it's two girls who kind of create this character of Mercy Black that they have to sacrifice something to, and then Mercy Black will make their lives better and take revenge on all those who have wronged them and kind of fix everything. But they have to sacrifice a classmate to this imaginary phantom that they have created. And they actually create her with like a mask and cloak and everything like that. And they stab one of their classmates a lot, who ends up living. And then it fast forwards 15 years. And we now see our main girl coming out of the mental institution, or I guess I'll call it like more of like a therapy home, where she's been for 15 years, going back home and finding out kind of that the town still thinks she's nuts, that everyone's still kind of scared of her. And as soon as she goes back into the house, which now belongs to her sister, her mother has died now and it's her sister's house, she starts getting visions of Mercy Black, and she starts feeling like Mercy Black is back in the picture. And she's convinced herself at this time, 15 years later, that Mercy Black wasn't real, that it was just something that they had thought up in their heads when they were kids, and that it wasn't real. But she's seeing it through her nephew now as well, who is starting to kind of pick up things around the house as well. This one had some really good jump scares. Like, there was definitely a couple moments in this that I was not expecting, that I definitely gasped and shook on my couch. So yeah, it's got some really fun jump scares. Super light movie, just fun little haunted supernatural film. And it's on Netflix now.
Written and directed by Owen Egerton, mm-hmm. by the way, who did Bloodfest, which was one of my picks last year, mm-hmm. which I really loved.
Owen Egerton from Fantastic Fest and Rooster Teeth.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I really dig. He's one of us, and yeah. I really dig that he keeps trying to do different types of horror.
Yeah,
yeah. Mercy Black is decidedly much different in tone.
It is. Yeah, yeah. This one, there's definitely some moments with the mythos where I was like, wait a sec, didn't you just say – that's kind of the only thing that I was like, nah, the mythos a little bit here and there. But for the most – like if jump scares, I was totally watching it and down in popcorn the whole time.
What happened to the mythos, Ryan?
Wow. I will ask questions off
spin-off
air.
Spin-off podcast.
Wow, Jesus.
No,
you can't handle Mercy the Black, hard question.
Mercy Black actually has a really interesting history. Mm-hmm. It began as a Blacklist script that came to us from Ray Roberts, who is an executive who we lost last year. Mm-hmm. And she's one of the producers on it. And it came in, and it was called The Boy. And
there's been a few called The Boy, I guess.
Yeah. And the title was the least of our worries in terms of that. But yeah, it was something that there was a bidding war for, and we jumped on board. But yeah, it was a fun development process, and mm-hmm. Owen was absolutely terrific to work with.
Yeah, and there are some really super tight shots in it, especially when they're in the house. Well, the third act is fucking nuts.
Yeah, it's super cool. But if you look at Mercy Black and you look at the house that she lives in with mm-hmm. her sister, that is the house from Texas Chainsaw Massacre: The Next Generation.
Are you fucking serious?
I was on.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah, I was on. I was on set somewhere, and the producers, Divide and Conquer, who are the producers on this, they text me and they're like, "So we're on a scout, and I think we're going to go with the Texas Chainsaw 4 house." And I was like, "Need pictures now!"
Yeah.
And I was like, "Oh yeah, that's the house."
Gosh, that is
like,
crazy.
And I was like, "You better shoot there."
They shoot the shit out of the house. Yeah, it's great. There's some really good scares built out of the structure and the architecture of it.
Yeah, that's cool.
Nice. Can I ask a question, Phil?
Sure.
Have you seen anything in the last 2 weeks?
Well, I said The Perfection, but apparently I got the timing wrong.
Oh, but you said that. Oh.
Ryan wasn't ready to talk about that yet, Phil.
I wasn't ready to talk about it because it did not have a home. It has a home now, so I think it's free game. You know, it's go for it.
Gotcha. Well, I watched a documentary that I thought was really cool called Scream Queen, My Nightmare on Elm Street.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I've been wanting to see
about part two?
Yeah. Oh. Well, it's literally about Mark Patton.
Yeah.
And it's about what he was dealing with at the time that he made the film. What he was dealing with was being a not quite out gay actor in Hollywood at the height of the AIDS crisis, where like you'd have to get a blood test if you're going to have a kissing scene with somebody, and sort of the it's I guess the arc of it is about him wanting to reconcile how that film kind of upended his career in a psychological way, and how the narrative that took hold was that it wasn't a gay film, but the gay dude in it made it a gay film just by his presence. And it's about him wanting to sit down with the screenwriter of the film and confront him and say, you've put all of the gay stuff that this film's been credited with on me, and I want you to admit that it's in the script. And it's a very emotional movie. He goes through a lot of stuff, and
he direct it?
No. He's a producer on it, but these two gentlemen named Tyler Jensen and Roman Cimienti directed it.
Got it.
And it's an interesting coming from them because like Tyler wasn't even born then. So it's about Mark Patton sort of wanting to educate the next generation of young gay filmmakers about, you know, what they went through. Yeah. As he points out in one part of the film, he goes, everyone from his generation is gone. They're all like – he said he was going to a funeral every week for 5 years. Mm. And and it's about him like sort of like imploding in the wake of that film. And then a big part of the plot is never sleep again.
Yeah.
They find him. They unearth him. He's in Puerto Vallarta, Mexico.
Right.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And he comes out of hiding and sees what I think is maybe the most impactful part of the documentary is how he's impacted a whole subset of fandom who have reclaimed – Elm Street 2, which is not the most gay positive film, even if whatever gay reading you take on that, it is not a very progressive look.
Yeah.
But it's about how the gay – there's a gentleman named Andrew Scahill in the documentary. He says gay horror fans are scavengers and they take what they can get. And so Elm Street 2, for all its problematic qualities, has become this sort of, you know, incidentally iconic gay film for them.
Yeah.
And the documentary is hitting festivals now. I don't know when it'll be like VOD or streaming, but it's a really cool look at a certain point in horror history.
Well, I remember reading about it in Fangoria issue number 2.
Correct.
And I put it at the top of my list. I really want to see that. Yeah. I didn't know it started making the festival round, so I'll have to put it on.
Yeah, it premiered last week.
That's cool.
Oh, yeah. Cool.
One other plug for gay horror. We talked about Knife and Heart last week.
Oh, yes.
There is a Chelsea actually tweeted at me and said there is an episode of Michael Verratti, who we all know from Trivia and stuff. He has a podcast called Dead for Filth where he did a one-hour interview with the director of Jan Gonzalez when he was in town. It is a kudos if Michael listens to this. He's a really good interviewer.
Michael's awesome.
It's a really good interview, and it's really about what's so interesting is the director is just like, I want the whole world to be queer, and I want every character to be in this world, and I want to change the world. The movie, it was really inspiring and just a totally unique look, and it made the movie make a lot of sense. Like, I love the movie, but I don't necessarily get it all.
Yeah.
And when I listen to him contextualize his interests, I'm like, I totally get what you're doing with this. It's a really worthwhile interview if you've seen the film.
I have seen the film, yeah. And now look for the interview. Thank
yeah, Dead for yeah. Filth is the show. I just pulled it up.
Very
on the,
cool.
Yeah, really good interview.
Nice.
Oh, cool. Phil, what are you doing in town?
Yeah.
What?
What are you doing in town? You got Monsterpalooza?
I got Monsterpalooza. I came to Monsterpalooza last year, and I was like a man without a country. I'm just wandering the floor going, hey, we're bringing Fangoria back, and I had nothing to show anybody, and I had nothing to like, you know, present. Right. And I did a Q&A with our Puppet Master cast at the time.
But
we had no table because we had nothing to offer you at that table. We weren't even taking subscriptions at the time. But now we're on our third issue and we'll be at Monsterpalooza. I think we've got T-shirts. We've got issue 2 and 3. Issue 1, we did not predict the reaction and it is gone. And it's on eBay.
So expensive on eBay.
It's on eBay for a lot of money.
Do you think that's mostly because of our unveiling or
yes.
The quality?
Absolutely. So Shockwaves
did
that.
Both the video and podcast version?
You guys opened those bags and the issue sold out and Shutter subscriptions went through the roof because of the back cover.
See, that's it. And it's
why don't we do every issue? I want to open every issue early.
I want you to open every issue.
So you bring back overseas Blu-rays and get them released here and we release
magazines. We open black
magazines.
Bags and it goes crazy.
Yeah. I think it's time to use our
we
powers.
Do unbox. Boxings here, guys.
There's no more black bags, though, guys.
I know.
We're working on this. the thing we switched out the black bags for were even worse. But it's a growing process, and we're getting there.
Having known all the insight on how this used to work, was it Canada that stopped the black bags?
No, I have a very limited understanding of this, but my understanding is that the black bag prevented it from being sorted in an automatic way, and it had to be sorted in a manual way. I don't know anything more than that.
Okay.
I was told
this was my world for 15 years, I know all about like the okay. Well, we can't put this on the cover because it's going to get stopped in Canada. Now this is going to keep us out of prison, so all of our prison copies are going
to
get returned.
What stops you from prison? What kind of stuff? I need you to know what doesn't get into prison.
Anytime that gore and sex were mixed together. So like we had one of the times that we were covering Gothic. And we had the boob eyes on, and it wasn't even like the center image. Uh-huh. It was in the film strip. And I got emails from prisoners. We had a sick amount of prisoners that subscribed, and they would write to me, and it was great because they would write these really long letters. Like I actually had pen pals during that time because they would write me about stuff in the magazine and everything. Wonderful people, surprisingly, at least over pen and paper. But they that one got stopped. There was the teeth issue. We had like a sexy image on the cover where it was like clearly kind of like a not sexy, it's teeth, but I mean she was nude and then there was gory stuff underneath. That one got stopped. So yeah it's it was always interesting. Like the dangle angle was a thing for a while. The dangle angle, and this was inside the issue where in order to be on newsstand, we could show a penis, but it couldn't be a certain amount of erectness.
Yeah.
And so there was actually a thing that we called the dangle angle where you'd like look at how upright it was.
This is within the magazine.
This is within the magazine.
Were you hanging a lot of dong and fango back then?
I don't think so. I heard stories about the dangle angle, but I never actually had to break out a protractor and measure the angle.
Yeah, no, we're very gore-centric, but When Dallas hired me for the thing, I described my era of Fango as pre-sexual. It wasn't a lot of TNA in the magazine. It was like – it was about the craft and about filmmaking. So we're leaning in that direction at the moment. But we're super psyched that there's – our fourth issue will be – it's going to be the 40th anniversary. Mm-hmm. And I know that you're going to maybe do something for us and Ryan's going to maybe do something for us because I'm trying to collect past contributors. We've got a piece from the guy who wrote Godzilla cover story in 1979. Oh, wow. He's going to be in there.
Nice.
Yeah, and it's pretty cool. But if I'm promoting anything today, it's that, after that fourth issue, these subscriptions are going to have been, those 1-year subscriptions are hitting their end, and all those free subscriptions we gave to past subscribers are going to hit their end. And I'm really hoping that folks will like what we've done so far and continue the ride with us and re-up because it's an expensive magazine to put out and we want to keep growing it. And we want it to be meaningful, but we need readers to do it. So, I'm hoping that people stick around for the second year because, we're still growing and evolving and who knows what's next.
We are treating him like he's been on the show before. Do you realize? I feel like we're we don't know your origin story.
I will say this. The thing that I love about this new iteration of the magazine, and again, I've been reading since I was like 15 years old, is I have issue 3 here, which is coming on the plane with me. I'm still not 100% done with issue 1.
Yeah.
And I've only scattered through issue 2. These do feel more like a book. There's so many different things I want to tackle. I do want to read it cover to cover.
Sure.
But sometimes it's like, oh, I want to read about this story or, oh, there's this short story in here. In fact, one of the pleasant surprises in issue 3, which I'll plug, is Paul Tremblay did it's kind of like a semi-sequel to Head Full of Ghosts.
Right.
But as a Fangoria, the letters column,
Zone,
he did a Postal Zone about Fangoria covering the TV show, the reality show within A Head Full of Ghosts. And if – I don't know if you guys have looked, but Rob Galuzzo complains about the Blu-ray.
I think you're all kind
you
of referenced
this,
in there.
I'm if Rion, you go to the Turk. End – you will find – you just passed it. There's a photo spread that I did with Barbara Crampton where you'll see a whole bunch of pictures of me there. And Barbara pulled a bunch of various level of horror directors now, people like me who are just super indie starting out low budget stuff up to like Mick Garris and asked us like what it's like working with actors, various experiences we've had, how we approach stuff on set and things like that. And so, yeah, it was just a really cool – piece to have in
this
there.
Morning, to be honest.
Yeah.
Cool.
Part of the whole fun of it is trying to figure out, like, it's like a missing puzzle piece. Like, everybody was sad Fango was gone, but when you looked at the landscape, Rue Morgue is doing a great job, and Diabolique is doing a great job, and there's all these websites doing a great job. So what would that puzzle piece look like now? And I think we're still trying to figure it out, but I also think that you'll see in there it's a very conscious effort to not be sort of giving you the same kind of content. How do we come at this stuff from a different angle? And I think something like Barbara, who's got a pretty unique point of view on like genre acting, you know, where she's not burned out and just wants to sign autographs or whatever either. She's super engaged, right? So her voice is so valuable to me in terms of our larger mission of honoring a legacy, but not just running in place and not telling the same old stories over and over again, right?
Right.
And that's what that Lifers column is about, where you get Kenny Caperton with his Myers house and the guy who bought the Texas gas station and to restore it. Just trying to tell different stories about fandom that are maybe a little left of People Magazine's sort of surfacey versions, right?
Yeah, I dig all of that. And I mean, like, I'm just curious about, you know, the other thing I was going to say too is I love that you brought back Gingold and Timpone to kind of like come back with their own angles. And, Gingold's kind of more editorial and Tony's more historical.
You know?
And I appreciate that view.
That's all credit to them because when we came back, we said, we're going to give you a space in every issue. And it can be whatever you want to be. And Tony sort of saw this arc for himself for like telling the early years, which has been a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And Gingold has been more like a point of view kind of thing in terms of like where's a space where he can talk about this particular part of genre that he maybe hasn't had a chance to somewhere else.
Right.
And those have worked out great. I love – those are my favorite two columns to read every issue pretty much.
So 5-year-old Phil is growing up in – where you grow up?
Central Jersey.
You go back in time and you tell 5-year-old Phil, hey, dude, you're going to run Fangoria.
And then 5-year-old Phil's going to be like, what's Fangoria? Because Fangoria doesn't exist when Phil's 5 years old. But 13-year-old Phil – would be pretty pumped.
Yeah.
And I kind of can't believe the year that I've had. Between this and Horror Noir, it's been just kind of a blur.
Yeah.
And it's been very satisfying. If it ends tomorrow, it's been a great ride.
But what did you – I mean, you had, I met you when you had just completed Halloween, Inside Story. But what was your trajectory? What did you want to do?
I think like most kids, I first got attracted to the idea of makeup effects.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so there's photo album after photo album at home of me with like liquid latex and cotton and collodion and all that other shit. And I just didn't have the mathematical discipline to go to the next level with that stuff. I was like a sort of halfway okay sculptor, but like when it came to foam latex and measuring shit, it was a mess.
Yeah.
So I think that what Fango did was – opened my eyes to all different kinds of craft, to the idea of storytelling and the idea of having something to say. Romero was a big part of that. You know, I learned about film editing. Everybody talked about Romero editing his own films.
Yeah.
And so I would watch that movie and watch the editing, and that was sort of my entry point. But I think in terms of my own storytelling, it's always been on the journalistic side of things.
Yeah.
I like learning about things and I like reporting about things. And it started as, you know, writing for like the Alamo Drafthouse. But in my day-to-day life, I was making nonfiction television since I was 20 years old. So it's been this sort of back and forth kind of thing. The thing that got me to Fango was I had basically interviewed Dallas Saunier about Bone Tomahawk, and that's how I got on his radar.
Interesting.
And that
was for Birth Movies Death, because before
correct.
Fango was Birth Movies Death. But what was where was your starting point when it came to film criticism and just write in journalism in general?
Someone just sent to me my eighth grade book review of Pet Sematary that was in the school paper.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Full circle.
Yeah, the book. but it was always just loving film and being that guy that everybody knew. I think we were all that guy or that gal. And I didn't know I was going to be making any kind of career out of it for a long time. I mean, like, I fell into production because I wanted to learn about filmmaking. But if you're falling into production on the East Coast and you're not in New York, there's not like a whole lot of film happening. So
you talk about nonfiction TV. What were you doing? Was it?
Gosh, I worked on game shows. Okay. I worked on home improvement shows. I did a couple seasons of Trading Spaces.
I had no idea.
Yeah. anything that a client was paying for. So sometimes it was commercials,
right?
But
right. Which is where Romero got to start as well.
Yeah.
I mean, he was
yeah, yeah.
You know, were you doing post production, or were you actually on the shoots for these things?
I was a field producer, and amongst that crowd of people, they sort of recognized that I could put words together mm-hmm. better than the next guy, maybe, and so I would get tasked with writing, and then, you know, and it was in that same company where I was doing that sort of like, you know, basic cable storytelling that that A&E first tasked us to do, like some biographies of Bill Murray, and then we did the 2-hour thing with Halloween and Fatal Attraction and Silence of the Lambs, and so that was like more. I got really excited about that.
There's a Fatal Attraction one.
Oh yeah, ooh. And it's better than the Halloween one, and I'll tell you why. Because and you'll know this to be true. The Halloween folks have been telling these stories for so long that they've polluted each other's memories to some degree, so that there's now just one narrative.
Yeah.
You could cut a sentence that starts with John Carpenter and goes to PJ Souls and then goes to Jamie Lee, and it's the same fucking story. And that's just the way the human brain works. There's nothing against any of them, but they've been hearing each other tell these stories for so long that it's kind of calcified into one thing. Yeah. Fatal Attraction was shot in New York. New York crews are born storytellers. They're hilarious. They got all kinds of different characters, and it was just so much more fun because no one had asked them this stuff before. And it became – it's one of my favorite documentaries that I've ever worked on.
Huh.
Weirdly.
Well, it's a wild movie, so it has to have a wild story behind it.
Yeah, yeah. It's great.
Okay. How can we see it now? Like, because I don't know. YouTube, is Halloween the Inside Story available somewhere other than
on
when planes. It
airs? You have to go on a plane.
Oh, on a plane. But maybe we'll see.
Wait till Halloween. They put it on a plane. I bought a DVD from England.
Oh, really?
Huh. And then it didn't get released here, so that trick doesn't always work. Sorry. they released Silence and Halloween over in the UK on disc.
As their own docs or mm-hmm. part of the movie as
no,
like a special feature?
Yeah, it wasn't a special feature thing.
Wow.
Yeah, it's just a little standalone disc.
That's cool.
Yeah. Must be cool not to get relegated to special feature. Scream documentary.
I just got my statement back on mine. It's not that cool.
Oh, no.
I'll find you Fatal Attraction. I'll get it for you.
I'm sure it's got to be on YouTube somewhere.
Probably. Are there crazy Adrian Lyne stories or –
He was great.
Okay.
He told some stories. Yeah. The craziest interview there was Nicholas Meyer, who did an uncredited rewrite on it. Yeah. I asked him one question and he talked for 45 minutes. And he's like, I don't know if that answers your question. I'm sure it did somewhere in there. But that was a wild ride. And that's where I met some bloggers actually on the Halloween thing. And that's how I started writing online. And writing online led to me meeting Dallas Sonier, who's the publisher of The New Fangoria. And I'm pretty sure I was his fourth or fifth choice, but it worked out. It worked out great. And he's been a fun – what?
Oh, nothing. No, you pointed to the magazine and I looked at it and it just reminded me of what I wanted to ask you.
Oh, please.
Well, no. Dude, Paul Thomas Anderson and Jordan Peele.
Yeah.
How the fuck did that go down? How did that happen?
Well, look, I have said this before that when I was my first year in LA that I went to a bookstore, Bookmark or whatever the hell it's called. And the first I walk in and there's just only Paul Thomas Anderson standing there reading the History of Horror book illustrated. And I started asking him questions about Thomas Pynchon. And he loved horror. And I was like, so him and Tarantino are interesting because they both have that in common, yet neither will probably ever make a conventional horror film,
even though there will be blood.
Yeah.
But I'm asking the question that the social media kids want to know because I see, you know, when they put up when Fango the cover was revealed, everybody was like, how the hell did that pairing happen?
You know?
So how did it happen? I mean, like, was it Jordan or was it you or what was it?
Well,
didn't they do a roundtable for the Oscars?
Maybe.
I think because what did they – weren't they – no, he was up for writer, right? For best Phantom writer for Thread. Get Out.
Yep.
My memory, because I like to watch those roundtables.
Yeah, they're great. They're
I'm pretty
fun.
Sure they were both on one of those. So they mm-hmm. must have known each other a little bit.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah. The pitch was – Jordan, who do you want to interview you for Fangoria? And, you know, in my sort of like trying to be helpful way, I thought he was going to give a hand up to some young journalist or something like that. And he came back with Paul Thomas Anderson. And I said, well, that works too. Yeah. That's fine.
Yeah.
And Paul Thomas – and if you read the start of it, the two of them are just vibing on how they used to have to save money up and decide between Starlog and Fangoria. And it's they're fans. Like we have this built-in goodwill. Even though Fango just went away for a little while, people were so excited when it came back that their opportunities like that are coming up because Paul Thomas Anderson is a fan of the logo, honestly, and he wanted to be part of it. It is confirmed by Gingell to be the longest thing that's ever run in Fangoria.
It is very long. I have not read it yet, but I skimmed through it really quick this morning, and I was like, wow.
Wow, that
which
is intense.
Which makes it substantial. It makes it an event to read. You know? I swear, I mean like getting through these new issues, it takes me a month.
Yeah.
It literally takes me a month. But then when I realize I'm like, oh, I got two more months until the next issue, then I'm like, I kind of slow my roll and just like slow drip it.
I feel like it should last a quarter, you know. Someone did complain that there were too many articles, and I didn't know how to really respond to that.
Wait, what?
Too many articles.
Too many articles. You know, so we doing what
and
we can
and not
here.
Enough.
Ads?
I'm so glad you guys cut that shit out. Oh, my God.
Well, you know, for now.
For now. Oh, okay.
Exactly. Listen.
Exactly.
No, I get. I mean, like, we had to do a solid 25%. If 25% of the magazine.
25.
25%. Sometimes more. It depended. But, yeah, 25% of the magazine was ads.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So what's the future of Fango hold? How does Dallas – like, what's the process like with Dallas? I mean, like – obviously, your magazine, he's more brand and legacy, like the kind of off-site stuff or what?
No, Dallas is a busy man. He's a CEO of a company. He's a film producer.
Yeah.
That's his heart. He wants to do that. But he wants to you know, he wanted to restore the brand basically so that he can make films under the brand.
Right.
He's hired me, Meredith, a gal named Jessica Saf of Amir, and some other folks in Texas to restore the brand. And we've pretty much done that to his satisfaction. Like you can imagine when I told him Paul Thomas Anderson was writing the cover story, he was pretty happy.
Yeah.
But he's a very – and I say this knowing he's going to listen to this and maybe yell at me. But like he's a very Texas dude and he wants Texas-sized, you know, fireworks.
For sure.
He wants it to be big and great and I want that too.
Yeah.
So I think it's a balance of he wants to see – appropriate coverage of the genre films that are coming out. I want to go in weirder paths and he kind of, you know, helps steer me in terms of making sure I don't get too far off the path and that sort of thing.
I guess my question is like in terms of – because Fango is doing music. It's doing podcasts. It's doing films.
Yes.
And I noticed that you're an EP on Satanic Panic, which is coming up. Is that correct?
Correct. Yeah.
So how much involvement do you have? I mean like – and how does that take away from the day-to-day that you have with the magazine and the duties you have there?
Dallas, I mean, it was an honorary thing.
Yeah.
Like, I'm going to get an EP credit on any Fangoria film while I'm the editor in chief of the magazine.
Yeah.
But he does tap me and ask me questions and like sends me a script, asks for notes. I'm going to take full credit for David Patrick Kelly starring in our new film because like I just walked in one day. I was like, "Has anybody called David Patrick Kelly?" And he was in the movie the next week. that's a film called VFW. You might have seen it in the trades a little
bit.
Joe Bigas.
But that cast—the cast is insane. It's Stephen Lang, Fred the Hammer Williamson, George Wendt, David Patrick Kelly, and Martin Cove.
Yeah, Martin Cove.
Which
Marty
is
Cove.
Yeah, and I'm going there next week, and they're having a lot of fun.
Oh, that's
so
cool.
I'm excited to see more. So, like, I have a voice in there, but it doesn't. It's not taking time out of my day.
Right.
The magazine is my problem.
It's a good
magazine
problem to have.
Yeah, it's a great problem to have. I'm super proud of it so far. I want to take it, you know, into even more unexpected spaces. I think there's – you guys probably know what I mean and I don't mean this in any kind of negative way, but the horror community can get a little incestuous and get a little samey.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to carve a space where Fango doesn't have to be that.
Yeah.
Like when I interviewed Jordan Peele for Horror Noir, I handed him Fango 32. And right across the top, it's Martin Scorsese's writing about David Cronenberg in that issue. And I said to him, this is where I want to take it back. And this was his answer.
Yeah.
He brought me Paul Thomas Anderson.
Oh, that's great.
And so I want to like – because who thought Paul Thomas Anderson had something to say about horror? And I want to find those other voices that you're excited to read but maybe you don't know that you're excited to read.
Mm-hmm. Right. And when they come across as genuine because I feel like what the great thing about horror fans is, yes, there is a little bit of sameness to everything we do but they're also there to call out – those who are disingenuous don't get the genre and maybe putting on a face of I love the horror, I love horror, I'm here to do this thing, and you're like no you don't,
and they don't.
You don't love it.
Yeah, that's fair, and I think that's my radar for that is pretty good as well.
Yeah.
But I also just want to if people are so nostalgic about this brand that they're going to show up to write for me, I want to open it up a little bit
for sure.
That's the dream.
Yeah.
That's super cool. All right, so 3 is out now.
Yes, it'll be hitting 3 will be hitting like. You know, your comic and specialty store shelves on the April 23rd.
Right. What do we – and you have this platform. What do readers or fans need to do to continue supporting Fango?
I would love for them
– getting it into stores as well.
Yeah. I mean getting into the stores is not it's not on the customer to do that. But if you go and ask your diamond-stocked – shop to order you a copy, you should be able to get a copy. But what – I mean, we really want people to subscribe. We want people to buy in for the year. It's 4 issues. It's, you know, 100 pages each issue, and we think it's worth it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So
I think it's worth it as well.
Yeah.
Well, Phil, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
I'm looking forward to hanging out at Monsterpalooza this weekend.
Yes. Come
you
by.
You all you scallywags, you guys have fun at Chattanooga.
Yeah, we have fun with us there.
Don't forget to rate and review us on iTunes and find us on social media.
Yeah.
All right. Have a good night, guys.
See you next week, guys.
Have a safe flight, boys.
Who are you casting as Bond?
Oh, God.
I know. Throw it out there.
Elric.
Dan Stevens.
Good choice. Good choice. See? I knew that would be the right answer. The Bond guest.
Yes.
Get ready to delve deep into the weird world of essential cult entertainment only on Full Moon's Amazon channel. Classic Full Moon and Empire Picture faves like Castle Freak, Puppet Master, Subspecies, Necropolis, Intruder, Head of the Family, Evil Bong, The Ginger Dead Man, Laser Blast, The Pit and the Pendulum, and Lurking Fear share space with a wild library of cult creepers from the legendary Blue Underground and Something Weird video labels, the Andy Sedaris and Jess Franco collections, as well as the Euro Archives, Trailers from Hell, and much, much more. This is an unlimited onslaught of awesome right at your fingertips 24/7. New uncut movies are added every week and all the titles are available in the highest definition available. So get yourself over to Amazon and subscribe to Full Moon today for only $6.99 per month. Your glaze balls will never be the same again. Trust us.
In just a couple of weeks, Shockwaves is heading to Texas Frightmare Weekend, presented by Arrow Video. The convention takes place May 3rd to the 5th at the Hyatt Regency Hotel at the DFW Airport. It's the Southwest's premier horror convention, now in its 14th year. Join the Shockwaves team for a live show on Saturday, May 4th at 11 a.m. in the Maverick Room. And look for us all weekend long at booth 31 and 32. Special guests this year include Bruce Campbell, Sam Raimi, Tim Curry, Robert Englund, Lee Majors, Meatloaf, Joe Bob Briggs, and many more. For further details, visit TexasFrightmareWeekend.com.
Severn Films has plenty of releases in store for you this May, and they're all available for pre-order at Severn-Films.com. In 1977, the legendary Amicus co-founder Milton Subutsky teamed with Canadian producer Claude Heureau for the killer cat anthology The Uncanny. Peter Cushing, Ray Milland, Donald Pleasant, Samantha Eggar, and Susan Penhaligon star in this grisly portmanteau. The Uncanny is coming to Blu-ray for the first time ever.
Plus, the world premiere of the hallucinatory epic from Gabe Bartolos, Saint Bernard. You know him from his unhinged effects work on Frankenhooker, Brain Damage, and the Leprechaun series, and now he brings his own psychotic vision to the screen. Frank Henenlotter calls Saint Bernard a wonderfully fucked up masterpiece. Look for it in May on Blu-ray and digital platforms. And new from Intravision, in 1994, a production team in eastern Pennsylvania brought together a group of local pro wrestlers and young actors to make a horror action film. A quarter of a century later, the movie was finally finished. The Masked Mutilator. When a psychopath wearing a wrestling mask begins butchering the teenage residents of a youth offender's home, their rehabilitation will become a no-holds-barred battle for survival. The Uncanny, Saint Bernard, and The Masked Mutilator coming in May, available for pre-order from Severn-Films.com.
Meow.